Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning basement finishing system for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com. And the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
On Boston Public Radio, today's the deadline for voter registration and our gubernatorial debate is tonight at 7. We'll open the lines and ask you, other than the governor's race, do you even know who's running for other statewide offices? How about what's at stake on the ballot questions? If you don't, stay tuned. We'll bring you our ballot box primer. From there, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us. If you thought prescription drug ads were annoying, from the litany of indecipherable side effects to the amorous couples sitting in their twin bathtubs, could the Trump administration actually give them some value by forcing Big Pharma to put a price tag on these pharmaceuticals?
At noon, national security expert Juliette Kayyem is here. With the Trump administration still giving the Saudi king a pass on the disappearance of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, are we losing all credibility when it comes to standing up for human rights abuses? That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So today is a special edition of Ask the Governor and Ask the Candidate Running for Governor. Tonight we're moderating a debate, Marjorie and I, between Governor Charlie... Marjorie said, it's tonight? No, it's not quite that bad. Tonight we're moderating a debate
between
Governor Charlie Baker and Democratic challenger Jay Gonzalez. We're taking your calls for the next few minutes. What do you want to hear from these two guys at 877-301-8970? With today being the deadline for voter registration in Massachusetts, we want to know, are you ready? Do you know what the races are? What's at stake with the ballot questions? Have you had your eye only on the federal races in 2020? Or you checked out, sort of like Sue O'Connell and Marjorie, placing bets on whether Prince Harry and Meghan Markle are having a boy, girl, or twins? Yep. 877-301-8970. Let me make a statement here.
No. How I had to fight tooth and nail to make you want to ask the first five questions?
I'm not asking the first five questions.
What's wrong with that?
What is wrong with that? In any case...
Jim, you're going to talk for 40 minutes.
Can I get
straight.
My point out? There'll be time for the candidates, too. Maybe at the end they can do a closing.
Can I do the last question?
By the way, it's 7 o'clock on TV, 7 o'clock on this radio station if you're not in front of a TV, streaming it at WGBHnews.org, et cetera. In all seriousness, other than the governor's race, and I consider Deal and Warren a federal race, are people paying attention to anything that is – the amount of coverage – by the way, between you and me or me on television, we have done a debate in every single constitutional office or will have done one. The one exception is auditor, and I apologize. We just didn't have time. Secretary of State, a treasurer, we're doing everything, attorney general. Do we get any calls? Do we get any email? Is anybody talking about any of the lower constitutional offices, the four below governor and lieutenant governor? Some of the Congress people have candidates. Incumbents have opponents. You don't hear about that. The amount of inattention, maybe that's not a proper English, paid to anything other than Baker Gonzalez, which, by the way, hasn't gotten a lot of attention. Deal and Warren.
Not much
it's
attention.
It's all Congress 2020. And talk about Donald Trump. It's a real problem with fewer than 3 weeks to go that there's been such little tension. So in any case, we want to know if you're the exception to, I guess, the rule that I'm stating. I hope you are. And if you want to give us any advice about what to ask at tonight's debate, we'll at least consider it. 877-301-8970. We may have a quiz question or two also to test your knowledge about what's happening in the state races on November 6th.
Okay.
You are going to ask some questions tonight.
That's right.
It's fine.
No, I'm up to two.
You are at the end.
Started out with zero.
A little later.
And those are the ones that if we have time. If we have time.
Yeah, if we have time, I said, you can do them.
I guess
we'll probably have time.
There won't be time,
and
Jim.
Well, if there
it's
isn't the time, you do them next time.
Question.
There'll be another election someday.
Okay.
It's not that big a deal. Don't be so sensitive.
Let's go to Rob in the
car.
It's
not quite that bad, by the way.
It's pretty bad.
Hi,
are
Rob.
You paying attention, Rob?
Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great.
Can I give my question first that I want you to pose to the governor?
Sure.
Yeah, I'd like to ask him, it'll be 4 years since the winter of 2015. What has been done to the T and that will prevent something like happening again this winter?
Okay, we got it.
That's a good one. The MBTA, that's a big issue.
Now, do you want to answer a question here?
Okay, I guess.
No, come on, be brave. Rob, who is not in the running in the race for the Secretary of State? Bill Galvin.
That's hard.
Anthony Amore. Am I asking you or am I asking
him? That's
hard. Juan Sanchez or Keiko Orrell? Which one of those four is not running for Secretary of State?
I'll guess the second. I know Galvin is, but...
That's okay. He is running. Anthony Amore is a Republican. Keiko Orrell is a Republican, not running for Secretary of State. She's running for state
treasurer.
Do you think, am I right, Rob, that beneath, and by the way, Margie and I are almost as guilty, other than the fact that we do this for a living.
I haven't heard of some of these people.
When you get below the governor's race and the Deal Warren race, virtually everything is below the radar, isn't it?
Well, no, I the congressional races I paid.
No, I meant federal races. We are paying attention. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, the ballot questions I usually pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Do you want to take a quiz on the ballot questions? We'll give our next
call. No, somebody else.
The
you know, by the way, Rob, you know, when I first started doing ballot campaigns 20-some years ago, a lot of my friends hated the ballot direct democracy. The reason I like it is because of what you said. Ballot campaigns do tend to cut through the candidate inattention. And most people do know what the ballot questions
are
and have a fairly decent idea of what the right decision for them is.
Rob,
thanks for the call.
I don't think that's true at all. I think there is immense confusion about the nurse's question. Immense confusion.
Which number is that again?
I believe that is number one. No, is that number one? I hope so.
It's
number one.
Question
this is
one.
What I do for a living here. I think there's because there's nurses on both sides, and I think the average person.
So read the stories. Read the voter information book.
You can read the stories, and you have nurses on one side saying this will cut down on our flexibility. It means we won't be able to do X, Y, and Z. You have nurses on the other side saying there's not enough nurses in attendance around certain patients. So there's two. It's very confusing.
It's like a lot of times. So would you prefer the legislature that's on a 5-month vacation to address? What would you? I mean, I would prefer representative democracy to do its job and have the legislators do it, but they happen to be on a half-year vacation, which you probably know.
Yeah, 5 months.
Whatever. 877-301-8970. If you have a question that you'd like us to consider for tonight's gubernatorial debate, great. But I'm most interested to know if people are paying attention to anything below the top of ticket kind of races.
Al in Middleborough. Are
Hello,
you passionate
Al.
About anything going on in the state of Massachusetts, Al? Al?
Oh, hi. I'm sorry.
Hi. Welcome.
Welcome. If you have a chance, I'd be interested in hearing what the governor and Mr. Gonzalez think about the complete lack of transportation infrastructure improvements in the southeastern region of the state. The South Coast Rail is being somewhat moved forward, but only phase one, so it's really going to leave a deficit. That solution only covers about 10% of the rides from the South Coast to Boston, and there's no guarantee that there'll ever be a phase two. So I'd be interested in hearing about that.
Yeah,
that's been talked about for a long, long time, has it not, Al?
Decades. Decades.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And what the proposal that's being put forth right now is not the preferred solution. It's a lame attempt, I think, at gathering votes for November 6th. But there's no phase two funding guaranteed.
Well,
that's the approach.
You know, Al, it seems to me, here we are talking about how wonderful the economy is and the lowest unemployment in decades and things are really humming along. It does seem like a time to take a big bite out of some of these big mm-hmm. issues for transportation. But then you have all these people all the time saying, we don't want to raise any taxes. We don't want to raise any taxes. We don't want to raise any taxes.
Well, some do and some don't.
Well, some do and some
well,
don't.
Well, that's a major bone of contention between the two guys we're going to be talking to tonight.
It's kind of like if we don't I don't know how we're going to – when you ride around – get far out of Boston and even around Boston, things are in pretty desperate shape.
Al, thank you very much for your call and your suggestion. 877-301-8970. Let's go out to Mattapan where Erica is on the phone. Erica, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, first time caller.
Ooh,
a long time listener.
We love that. Thank you for calling. What's up?
I'm calling in regards to the climate change and more aggressive measures that need to be made, especially from, you know, carbon capturing to changing over renewables, our utilities to renewables, recycling to various measures. I know we're doing stuff for water with parks and whatnot, but we need to do way more.
That's a good one, too.
We will take it under consideration.
Remember the pictures last winter of the dumpsters floating around down by mm-hmm. the waterfront? A dumpster floating.
Okay, so you want to take a question here, Erica, for your first call ever? You ready for this? Say yes, Erica, even if you don't want to say yes. This ballot question deals with a proposed law that would create a citizens commission to consider and recommend potential amendments to the United States Constitution to establish that corporations do not have the same constitutional rights as human beings. What question is that? Do you know?
It's either two or three. I know number one is the nurses.
Well, that's...
I would agree that I don't think corporations should have the same rights as human beings.
Okay, and it's question two on the ballot. It's an advisory kind of thing. It's a, it would not...
Okay.
It would create a citizens commission. Obviously, you can't amend the Constitution. But you, you got it. Erica, thanks for your first call. Hope you make a second one. Soon. By the way, am I more upset about the inattention? I think I'm quite right about the inattention to the lower offices. There aren't stories about them. I mean, we've done these debates and they get decent ratings because I think people actually want to hear something. But does anybody know who's running for auditor? I mean, I wasn't able to do a debate. We couldn't fit it in to our schedule. Does anybody know who's running for against Suzanne Bump? There are actually three people running against Suzanne Bump. And whether you love Bump or not, contests are good for small d democracy. It makes the incumbent, even if he or she wins re-election, I would argue, do a better job than they were doing before. These things are so under the radar. It is pathetic.
Well, I think you hope that people know a little bit more about what's going on in their own district in terms of state representative and state senator, but maybe not. We're talking about the midterms, asking you if you are ballot box ready. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. By the way, Marjorie and I are doing the second gubernatorial debate tonight,
yes,
live
are.
At 7 o'clock, radio, TV, and streaming. And it caused me to work myself into a frenzy about the fact that the lower races are not getting the attention they deserve. We're doing our best to get them attention, mm-hmm. hosting debates here on the radio or on television. The deadline for voter registration to vote on November 6th today, I hope people are paying attention to that. I hope I'm wrong. I hope there's a lot of attention being paid to everything. I just don't think that's true. Our number is 877-301-8970.
And if you tune in tonight at 7 o'clock and you wonder where I am, Jim has assured me that I'll get two questions.
No,
at the
that's
end.
Not fair. You know,
at the end of the debate, if there's time.
No, we're going to get email. People think that's serious. Did we divide the questions up evenly?
No, we did not.
Well, we will someday. Maybe not today, but maybe someday.
Okay.
Brineer, you're in Hyde Park. You're on Boston Public Radio. Great to hear from you, Brineer. What's up?
Good morning, guys. Thank you very much for trying to educate us about the elections.
And ourselves.
I think, Jim, I have a suggestion about shows that you guys might do in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I have a question for the candidates.
Okay.
Tonight about something that's been bothering me. The suggestion is a lot of people do not know what the officers on the lower races do. A lot of folks don't know what a sheriff does or what the auditor does, what the registrar of deed does. I think people assume people know. Where would we have learned that? Not in civic classes here. That's why people don't vote for those people.
I think you are so
point.
Dead on. It
yeah.
is frightening. You are totally and completely right. That's right. And by the way, you and I promise you we will do.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Between now, how many days are there left? 20 days till Election Day. We will do a segment, Bernier, and we'll promote it in advance, in which we will talk or at least read information on what the responsibilities of all these officers are. It's a great idea. What's your suggested question?
The other question I have is a pet peeve of mine. Remember I told you about that ticket that I got?
Yes.
Police that stopped me. Of course, I appealed it. I went there. There was this guy who basically was very rude. I told him, why would the police just stop me for a window that's tinted and give me a $250 ticket? And he said, the police is not there to defend himself. I said, didn't you tell me that there is one police that represents all the other policemen? He said, yes. I said, okay, so if you represent all the policemen, I said to the police guy, so don't you have discretion? And mm-hmm. he told me, don't ask him any question. I said, he said, what do you want to do? I said, I don't want to pay that ticket. And he increased the ticket. He increased the ticket by another $50. That's what he did.
What did they argue? Maybe that was the cost of the proceeding? Is that what they argued?
I was so upset, Jim. I don't even know. But the question that I have for the governor and those people is, why is it that we have to pay $25 to appeal something, and it's non-refundable? So doesn't that give the police or the state an incentive to just ticket people for no reason, because they're going to make the $25 no matter what?
And there's a disincentive for us to fight it. I think that is – by the way, I've had the exact same experience. Bernier, I'm with you.
That's
we'll do our best. Thanks
point.
For the call. Or if we can't ask that question, we can ask if either of the candidates wants to pay Bernier's ticket. That's another – no, I'm serious. I mean, I assume that would be of some
– listen to this. This is from Gwen.
Thanks, Bernier.
I have 7 signs on my lawn in Auburn, she says. Elizabeth Warren, Joe Early, vote yes on 1. Jim McGovern, Kate Toomey, and 2 for local representative challenger Terry Burke.
That's great.
Dawson,
I love that.
Blue Wave.
I love
so,
that.
Wow, that is really impressive.
Don't you have any of those? Are you lawn signs allowed in Brookline?
No,
or not?
No. My downstairs neighbor wanted to put one up, but I'm not supposed to.
No, I don't mean because you're a journalist, but are they allowed at all? They are.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I've seen a lot of signs in Brookline. I saw tons of signs on Cape Cod. When
I
was
tell me that.
From my sister's
house.
Yeah.
Well, you know why? Because people vote. They're older for the most part, and people vote. 877-301-8970.
Jeff Deal signs.
Really?
Tons of them. Alicia in Plymouth.
Well, that's actually one of the more Republican parts of the state, is it not? Yeah.
Alicia,
I'm sorry.
Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
Hi. I'm so excited to call.
Thanks.
So I also see hundreds of Deal signs up here, and I also in Plymouth, and I see Vinnie DiMacedo signs that I just found out they've been putting them on, like, properties of businesses that they don't even know that they're there. So I'm part of this sort of underground Democratic group, and that has just come to the attention that, like, a lot of local area businesses are getting, like, all these Republican signs put on their property, and they haven't even asked anybody for it. So there's, like, this really crazy sort of battle going on down here in Plymouth, and I'm excited to see it. But at the same time, people my age, I'm 37, I don't, like, nobody has any idea what's going on, except for me, I feel like, when I talk to, like, you know, people my age about it, you know, so.
God, I hope you're wrong. I have the exact same feeling you do about, I mean, Alicia, I assume people are focused on Washington, right? But the problem is we don't have that many contested congressional races here. We obviously have the Senate race and a few of the congressional districts, but in-state stuff, people are just not into. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, totally. I feel like they're just, it's not part of their everyday life, so they just don't want anything to do with it. And but meanwhile, you know, we have a town meeting coming up this Saturday morning, and there's going to be, like, a meetup of all of our Democratic people, because we just opened a new office downtown, like a headquarters, like a Democratic headquarters, and we're all going to meet at like 6:15 in the morning so we can stand out and at the town meeting, you know, and show our support for our local Democratic people running, because it's like it is getting pretty contested, which is great. But like I said, people my age aren't even paying attention.
Well, hopefully that standout is going to encourage them to pay attention with whatever it'll be then, 17 or 18 days. Alicia, thanks for bringing us up to speed on your area.
It's cliche to point out that people that vote get paid attention to. The old joke forever in Boston that South Boston, which historically was a poor part of town, but people in South Boston voted. So the housing projects were a lot nicer there. The parks were not nicer there. You could triple park on Broadway, exactly, because people were really devoted voters there. And, you know, you vote, you're the squeaky wheel, you get paid attention to. Anyway.
Don't forget, debate 7 o'clock tonight, TV
o'clock
and
tonight.
Radio and streaming on WGBHnews.org.
And by the end of the day, I'm hoping to move up from 1.5 questions to 2 questions that aren't at the end of the debate when everyone's gone home. Coming up, in the UK, doctors are cooking up a prescription to deal with their loneliness epidemic. It's a great idea for here as well. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Scientifically, the methods used to analyze Senator Warren's DNA hold up. But ethically, is she letting Native Americans down? Is it problematic if she uses genetics to appropriate cultural kinship? Join us online to talk about this, how the Trump administration is aiming to Bigfoot Big Pharma into disclosing the price of their prescription drugs on TV ads, and other medical ethical headlines is Art Kaplan, Arts of Doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hello, hello. I've just determined that I am 1/2 millionth Cro-Magnon.
Really?
I'd say it's a little higher, actually, but we'll discuss that later.
So let's start with this, our own Senator Warren. She's getting some blowback, including from Cherokee Nation, about releasing the results of her DNA test. What's the ethical problem here, Art?
Well, I'm afraid that Senator Warren has really stepped in it. She has gotten herself in one heck of a pickle by trying to figure out or answer this claim that she falsely asserted she was had a Native American ancestor or might be counted, some would say, as a person with Native American background. Trump, you recall, Marjorie was making fun of her. I think he kept calling her Pocahontas in his indelibly racist manner, but there he was. But she sort of took the bait and I guess decided I better clear this up before in my Senate campaign, or I better think about it down the road if I run for president or something. So I'm going to take a DNA test and we'll resolve all this. And listeners will know that the DNA test showed that between 6 and 10 generations back, she probably had some sort of Native American ancestor. Remember all that?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
By the way, 10 generations would be roughly 400 to 500 years ago.
Yeah.
If any of us were to look back 500 years, we'd find all kinds of fascinating ancestors, Mongols and, you know, who knows. People move around, shall we say, and they either hook up or have coerced sex, all kinds of things going on. But you don't become a Native American because you have a Native American gene.
But she's
culturally
not a,
is how you.
But in fairness, you know, we've interviewed her tons of times. And by the way, in July on my television show, she said she would not give in to a bully. She would not take a DNA test. She obviously had change
that
of
was
heart.
The correct answer.
But by the way, she has never. In fact, she explicitly said in response to the Secretary of State of Cherokee Nation, "I'm not claiming membership in a tribe. I understand there are different criteria." All she's, I think, trying to say, unless you may feel differently, Art, which is what she's always said, is somewhere in my background,
but
the family lore
has
been.
That's not all she said, though.
What?
What she talked about for a long time before this DNA thing even came up was the family lore, so that she contributed to something called the Pow Wow Chow Cookbook. She wrote recipes for that. This was part of the family stories that they talked about. So
but she wasn't claiming tribe membership
at
any time.
But she talked about the cultural milieu in her family that was heavily Native American.
I think I'm on Margie's side here. She's been hinting that it made a difference in her life or that it was part of a family discussion. But if you have a Native American ancestor 400 years ago, that's a pretty powerful through the ages impact on you. I don't buy it. And I don't think that in any way does the DNA tell you anything about, you know, what you ought to make of having somebody look, even 400 years ago, if you found a marker for Native American, it isn't even clear that they knew what the tribes were at the time. There's been some talk about it's Cherokee and this and that. I don't know, 400 years ago, who was where in terms of trying to trace back to a particular tribe. So I'm going to say, I don't buy this argument that because this DNA test shows a tiny influence of one or two genes, that it in any way is relevant to anything about her, whether she said it weakly, whether she said it strongly. It just doesn't matter because it has nothing to do with who she is. It's a dead end for her, and she's not going to win taking DNA tests to refute Donald Trump.
We're talking to Donald Trump on the phone. Oh, I'm sorry. We're talking to Art Kaplan on the phone right now,
Art
medical
Kaplan.
Ethicist.
Listen, I'm always looking for good
By
stuff.
By the way, there was something weird. You know, Donald Trump has a weird thing to say every minute, but didn't he say something like, well, I'd like to test her myself, but that would be disgusting?
That is what he said.
I think it's in a long line of insulting remarks about women and things that they do that are disgusting, which we don't need to get into at the moment because...
Yeah. No, it was an attack. It's like the horse face thing, the disgusting comment about Stormy Daniels.
Right.
Anytime he can slight a woman's appearance, or, I mean, it's just, it's nauseating. In any
case, let's move on because I did find something to champion and that I'm really happy the president...
But let me, I just want to stress this.
What?
We have a one-drop rule in the U.S. You're black. If you have any sort of black ancestry, that's racist. It doesn't have anything to do with the genetic contribution. You have to look at all this genetic stuff. I think I complained about this back in the World Cup, if you two remember. 23andMe was running an ad about root for your genes because there was no American team in the big international soccer championships. They said, well, you know, you could root for somebody, take a DNA test and then figure out whose genes are like yours and root for them. Are you kidding me? Really? You're going to go that racist? You're going to say, well, the Panamanians, they have a distinct genotype. You know, they've been around as a country since 1905. So my point is, not only is it bad to respond to Trump at all about this, I mean, I just would say, go screw yourself and move on. But we don't want to fuel racist ideas about who's who and who's in what group by thinking, well, we could solve all this with a DNA test.
By the way, Barack Obama took the bait too, Art Kaplan, as you well know, when he produced the long-form birth certificate.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, to me, it's sort of like, please.
We're talking Art Kaplan.
I'm not going down those highways.
Well, I want to get back to saying something nice about the president since I'm criticizing him all the time. His administration has a great idea, I think, forcing drug companies to disclose the prices in those endless TV commercials that we all hear about all these drugs, these miracle drugs, never say how much they cost. Disclose the sticker price. Isn't this a great idea?
Oh, you're too kind, Marjorie. It depends on what you hope to achieve. So are people going to drive the price down when they learn what the prices are? No, because most of us have no connection to paying those prices. They get paid by third parties, insurance people, you take out your drug prescription benefit card and pay a copay or something. When I first heard of this, I thought, oh, well, you know, this is one more attempt to use the market and an educated consumer to drive prices down. But then I thought about it some more, and I am going to give some kudos to Trump and Azar and Gottlieb and the health side of this because it does remind us all the time what the heck these things cost, and that is important. I mean, just keeping the issue kind of in our face. You want to do direct-to-consumer advertising, then you have to say something about the price of things. It even might have the wondrous impact of getting rid of some of these ads. I mean, who can watch any type of news program without fearing that your bowels are falling out and your throat is closing?
That's all that 60 Minutes is, by the way. But the only thing weirder than you two sort of supporting what the president's doing is I think I'm about to support one of the big pharma's arguments. Well, I'm a huge transparency guy. One of the arguments they make, which has some resonance with me, by the way, it only would require disclosure if the drugs cost more than $35 a month, just to get the details in there. So let's assume a drug is really, really expensive. They say it's $1,000 a month, for argument's sake. It may not be $1,000 a month because after insurance, it may be $5 a month. But it may scare off a low or moderate income person who needs that drug. And without talking to a physician or a medical professional, they may say, oh, my God, I got to do an alternative or something else because I can't afford $1,000 a month, not realizing that insurance might cover a lot of it. That's not a I know they're doing it as a CYA thing, but it's not required by the Trump people.
No, but I think it would be – you could certainly say that. You could certainly say the drug costs
$1,000,
but most insurance will cover it or check with your insurance company.
Okay, well, if they did that, then I'm fine. But the concern they raise that I'm echoing is not illegitimate if they don't do that. Is that not right?
Well, I thought you were going to go in a slightly different direction, Jim, and say – free speech, you can't make us say stuff. I mean, you can't make
us. I don't buy that.
The counterargument to that is it's a public interest thing, and then we make them say things all the time, including that litany of miseries that are in the ads that we were just making fun of about your headaches and your bloatedness and all the rest of it. So it may actually drive some of this stupid direct-to-consumer advertising off of television, yeah. which I would love. Every time I watch one of these ads, I keep thinking, you know, one comes on and says, well, here's this new medicine for lung cancer and blah, 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 and it has these horrific side effects, but more life is possible. Ask your doctor. And I keep thinking, if you have to ask your doctor about what's the latest cancer drug, you need a new doctor. Right? I mean,
we got to take a break.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. I'm going to keep talking to him after this brief break. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
If you listen to Boston Public Radio 3 hours a day, that's 15 hours a week, 60 hours a month, and 720 hours a year. Maybe it's time you pitched in. Call 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
So how's this sound? You can power your phone wirelessly and you can power WGBH at the exact same time with a gift of just $10 a month. How, you might ask? Well, you can get what we have today as an incentive for you guys. It is this little wireless charger. It's a little white thing. It says WGBH on it. It's round. It's a disc. I did not even know about this, but apparently Jim knows all about
that. I don't have a GBH one, but I have one.
You just put your phone down on top of this little disc. Looks like a little teeny tiny hockey puck, and it charges your phone. And you don't have to worry about sticking things into the portal of your phone and wearing out the portal. That's what you get for $10 a month. It's pretty neat. We always give you pretty neat incentives, and this is a particularly neat one as well. The number is 888-897-9424, WGBH. .org.
You know, and also, I assume this is clear to people. Not only do you pay with your money for shows like this and all the great news things and interview things that happen on the station, Marjorie has been whining on the show that she may not be allowed to ask any questions at the debate we're doing together
tonight. Every question that you decide needs to be eliminated is my question.
But in truth, we'll discuss that off the air, please.
No questions
but
left.
But this debate tonight, WGBH, and luckily we're the lucky ones who get to be the moderators,
are
doing a debate in a really important race between Jay Gonzalez, Democratic challenger, Republican incumbent, Charlie Baker. Without your contributions, this is not rhetoric, friends. There would be no debate. That's one of the – this is a really expensive proposition, a really expensive proposition. It happens because you decide to call 888-897-9424 or WGBH.org. We've done a ton of debates, by the way, both on the radio. We've done ballot questions. I will have done on TV every single constitutional office except for order.
No,
that wasn't my
point.
That was not my point.
He's debate king.
That was not my point. My point was your money is ensuring that you have an opportunity to hear from the candidates running for office. That matter. So again, and the hockey, it's not a hockey puck. The wireless phone charger thing is a great little additional gift for $10 a month. But apart from that, if you care about debates, you care about information, you care about understanding what's going on around you, and we learn too, by the way, give us a buzz, 888-897-9424, WGBH.org. And if you give an extra $10, I'll let Marjorie ask a couple of questions during... Is that, can I do that, or is that a violation of some law?
I mean, you are the debate czar. The czarina over here would just like to get a few minutes so that it's not like people would listen to the radio show and say,
where is she?
Are you even there? Are you even there? Anyway, I want to thank Mary Ellen in Reading, Kathleen in Cranston, Stella in Medford, Ellen in Arlington. Thank you all for helping us keep things going here at WGBH. Number again, 888-897-9424, WGBH.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, medical ethicist Art Kaplan has been yelling at me, and he's continuing to join us here on Boston Public Radio. Welcome back,
hey,
Art.
Can I say something about Pledge Week?
Sure.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
You get asked all the time about the unbelievable remuneration I receive for appearing with you two. And let me make clear, not a nickel, not a penny
will
go to me. If you give money to the station, none of this is wasted on people like me. So there's a huge motivation.
Yeah. Well, we hear you're a big high roller down there in NYC, Art Kaplan.
There we
are. That's what we hear.
There we are.
Anyway.
I buy drugs for anybody, no matter what the price.
So I love this story, too.
Which one?
We read a lot about loneliness
being
a problem, especially for people that are elderly and live alone. they have this program in England that where they'll people will get referred, I believe, by their physicians, right, to cooking classes or walking clubs, or you go to the doctor and he says,
"They can prescribe it."
Yes,
they can prescribe it. I love this.
Me
this
too.
Is so good. I like it partly because it recognizes a problem. So we spend oodles of time wondering about who's going to get a scarce transplant or a face transplant's okay, or we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, some breakthrough drug and who could get it and who could afford it. There's this huge problem, not just in America, it's in Japan, it's in many societies, where older people are just lonely. And it leads to all kinds of health problems, you know, not just mental health, but even physical health.
Like heart attacks and strokes and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. And stress causing a lot of these things. People not living or eating well and stuff because they're depressed because they're lonely. Have we given this any thought at all within our healthcare system? No. We warehouse people and everybody's terrified of going to the nursing home. Whether that's right or wrong, the terror factor is there. And part of it is the loneliness or the isolation, or I'm just going to sit there in a room and watch, you know, daytime television, which would certainly bring my life to a rapid end. But the my own hand, I mean. But this breakthrough of saying, first, let's recognize we've got a problem. And then let's start to think about ways we could do it, like I'm going to prescribe that you go to a cooking class or learn how to play card games or whatever it is. I don't really care. Or bring the pet therapy dog around and all the rest of it. Bravo to them. Let's do it. Let's get after this. It's a big public health problem.
Are we anywhere near? This is so obvious to me as a non-medical professional, but as a big-time consumer of the medical profession. Are we anywhere near this anywhere in this country, or is this as aberrational as it sounds in the UK?
It's pretty aberrational, sorry to say. You know, we spend our money on high-tech treatments and big-time hospital intervention when we get over to the home visits or the long-term care or the nursing home side. No, we're chintzing and we're not paying attention, and no, we're not there yet. We really got to push hard here because, look, most of us are going to encounter this problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of, if we don't die young, we're going to be facing the fact that our kids don't visit or the family died before we did
or your
whatever.
Friends.
You know, they moved away to somewhere else. And things that facilitate social contact, making friends, having activities, it just can't overestimate how important this is and how we got to kick. I mean, when's the last time anybody in a healthcare debate said anything about long-term care, much less the problem of loneliness? I mean, never.
Well, except, you know, the one thing I realized when I said, is it aberrational in this country? Aren't some states experimenting with using Medicaid money to deal with housing and those sort of issues, saying that, you know, the problem for a lot of people who are either underhoused or obviously homeless is they don't have an apartment, which is bad for your health in addition to bad for your psyche. Aren't some states seeking some waivers around Medicaid spending, or am I making this up?
If you are, I don't know that. But what I will say is this. We've sequestered housing as an issue separate from health, right? Separate departments, different bureaucratic geniuses running the different big programs at the federal level, often at the state level. They ought to really be merged together. Housing, whether you're homeless or in a long-term care facility where they just warehouse you, those are health issues too, and we ought to treat them that way. We shouldn't just say, oh, well, you know, over here is housing and
I
over there,
agree more.
That's where we think about health care.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. You know, Art, we had this question of assisted suicide on the ballot a while back in Massachusetts, and it started out very popular, and then with a lot of false advertising, it lost big time, scaring
Catholic
people. Catholic Church, I thought, was very disingenuous about its ads, you know, that we're all going to try to plot to kill grandma and stuff like that. But anyway, this new story says that even though the AMA, the biggest physicians group in the country, is against assisted suicide, this American Academy of Family Physicians wants to call it something different, medical aid in dying, and change its stance to, quote unquote, engage neutrality.
From opposition, right?
From opposition, exactly.
Yeah.
Is this a big deal?
So that's a big deal. When medical groups move, the AMA has not yet, but this is another major group. It's the primary care docs, family medicine docs, and when they sort of say we don't think it breaks the Hippocratic Oath and it doesn't violate our ethical standards. At least we're going to move to neutrality. Yeah, I think it's important. And I think it's, by the way, accurate. The difference, when people don't like assisted dying for the terminally ill, they tend to talk about suicide and helping a suicide. But if you're terminally ill, you're going to die one way or the other.
Right.
That's sort of the trigger point. And then you're just trying to help the person die with dignity. That's what the MAID idea is. That's why they're using a different term. Look, we've got many states now that have this. California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Vermont, actually. I don't see big crises. I don't see people rushing grandma off to the hereafter. I haven't seen people with disabilities being dragged in and killed because they cost too much. It's basically very restricted. It only applies to people who are terminally ill who ask and are competent to ask for aid. They have to take the pills. I think I mentioned this before, of the people who ask for pills, and there are not a lot of these folks who do this. Most people just want to go to hospice and live as long as they can. But about a third of them never take the pills.
Yeah.
They just like having the
option.
Peace
of mind. That's a big deal, I think, for people, because I think if you're afraid of pain, and who isn't afraid of some very painful death, that you have the peace of mind that you may not, that you don't have to endure it if you have, you know, a way to just anesthetize yourself.
It's kind of a parachute idea. You don't have to sort of use it, but it's sort of sitting there, and you know that lets. I'm going to say something that's pretty controversial. I think some of the legalization of assistance with dying has actually prevented some suicides.
That's
a great point.
I'm sorry. Say that. Why do you think that? Because I agree with you. But
in other words, if I say to Jim, "Here's a bottle of pills, and if things get really horrible, you could take them." You know that's there, and then you think, well, I'm going to go on, and I'm not going to take them because I'm going to, you know, I could, but now that I know I have an out,
exactly.
I'm going to struggle on.
Okay, all right, what's on the Everyday Ethics podcast?
You know, we were going to I won't tell you what we were going to do, but we're going to have to shift around. We're doing the genetics thing. I haven't even taped it yet, but we got to go back to the what makes us who we are. Do we define ourselves by our ethnicity, our tribe, our group, or even membership in the WGBH listening audience by genes? I think no.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big fan of genetics telling us what group we're in. I think what we'd find overall is we have a lot more genes in common than we do that are different between individuals, and that gets lost when we're looking for the differences to define people.
Okay. Art, thanks.
All right, thank you very
much. As always, great to talk to you.
Hey, my pleasure.
Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Drs. William F. and Virginia Comey MIDI Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Up next, our national security expert, Juliet Kime, is here for an update on the Hurricane Michael recovery efforts. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, the Trump administration is thinking about a plan that would once again separate kids from their parents at the border as a way of deterring families from coming here illegally. We've seen how effective their zero tolerance worked out, so why, when there's still 245 migrant children separated from their families, would they give this disastrous policy a reboot? National security expert Juliet Kime joins us for this and more. Then we look at a new NOVA documentary about the opioid epidemic and how new science is effectively treating it by looking at addiction as a chronic disease, not a moral failing.
Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us to talk about a wave of corporate activism with companies and CEOs wading into the political waters. Are they challenging the Trump administration because of principle or to turn a profit? Then we wrap things up with Cy Montgomery and another wonderful edition of Afternoon Zoo. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. So amidst global pressure over the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi, President Trump is still clinging to the Saudi arms deal, and he's now defending Saudi Arabia against accusations of their involvement. This is what he told the Associated Press. Here we go again with, you know, you're guilty until proven innocent, and then comparing this to the Kavanaugh situation. In any case, is this reaction totally compromising our credibility when it comes to defending human rights? Joining us for her take on this, the rising death toll from Hurricane Michael and other national security headlines, is Juliet Kayyem. Juliet's on the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School, an analyst for CNN, and CEO of Zemcar. Hello there, Juliet.
Nice to see you both.
Well, Juliet, let's get back to Khashoggi in just a second. Okay. There was some breaking news this morning from Bloomberg News saying that Robert Mueller is ready to deliver key findings after the elections, didn't say exactly when after the elections, in the Trump probe, focusing in on whether there was collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign and whether there was any obstruction of justice going on. What does that mean? What will he do if he releases his findings?
Right. So let's just put this in perspective. The Mueller team has been pretty good about not having leaks or even sort of showing their hand. I mean, we've been surprised by indictments, of, you know, and guilty pleas that we never even imagined were happening. So I do want to just put a certain amount of skepticism around the sourcing of this in terms of what the play is. But it could be that the Mueller team is notifying Rosenstein's office of what the plan is and to anticipate it, because obviously it will be a big deal.
Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, right, who's in charge of this because Sessions recused himself.
If he's still in
right.
office by that.
Right.
And these findings may not be public. I mean, they may be, you know, look, we're continuing the investigation, but here's what we found so far. Or here's why our investigation went this way. So, you know, this idea of a report has always been, okay, that's what Mueller is going to come up with. But that's not only he comes up with. I mean, in other words, this report could lay the foundation for half a dozen more indictments. Clearly, I'll tell you, the president seems agitated again about this investigation. He was tweeting a lot about it yesterday. So maybe there's an interview or an indictment coming down. So while this news is interesting in the sense, I guess the takeaway for me is nothing will happen between now and the election. But I don't know the conclusiveness of a report. It may very well be that the report is, here's what we found. The president is exceptionally compromised. We don't want indictment. Guess what, DOJ, your turn.
But here's
public.
What I'm wondering about, because we don't know what will happen post-elections with Sessions. We don't know what will happen with Rosenstein. I thought we confirmed it was Rosenstein.
Rosenstein, yeah.
It is,
in any case, with Rosenstein.
Right, goes with actually so, Frankenstein, someone
Frankenstein,
told us.
Rosenstein,
yes.
Right.
That That's not a political statement,
that
by the way, at all.
He's pretty much a straight arrow.
Yeah.
And that, but you don't know, he could be gone.
Yes.
So you don't know, and the information would go to him, and he decide what to do with it. So if Trump—
Wait, doesn't it go to Congress? I thought the report is presented to Congress.
It's first to him.
Okay. Yes. And then I believe—
It's a law enforcement report. You wouldn't send it first to Congress.
Right. But then doesn't that person in the Department of Justice, whether it's Rosenstein or somebody else, decide what to do with it? That's
yes.
what I'm wondering.
Whether it's made public or not,
exactly.
And what public means.
So
and
there's
what
a lot
pieces.
Of discretion
yeah,
there.
Yeah. So there's still a lot to unfold. And as I've been saying, the evidence in the report may be quite conclusive about certain
or not
aspects, right? But let's just go down the certain path, and those may lead the reasonable person to conclude that the president is compromised for XYZ reasons. But that doesn't mean that it's up to Mueller to decide what we do with the president of the United States, right? So the ultimate judgment is probably, you know, I don't think Mueller's going to indict the president if he even can. And no one wants it to get to that stage.
You know, there's one other thing. I mean, I know this is obvious, but why not state it anyway? Is, again, without taking sides, who wins the House of Representatives is huge here. If
huge.
It turns out, we've seen under Devin Nunes, who is a little, you know, essentially the potted plant who— essentially is the gopher for the president of the United States. He happens to be chair of the House Intelligence Committee. If Democrats control, there will be hearings.
Yes.
Maybe you don't want hearings. If you don't want hearings, then voting for the Republicans is probably a good idea, because the likelihood is good is they will say it's all fake news, it's a fake report, and maybe it won't see the light of day, especially since Mueller is not a leaker. So in any case, let's talk about this Saudi thing.
Yeah.
You know what's most upsetting to me? And maybe it's because I'm not a diplomat, and maybe because I don't understand how that world works. And I know there are compromises around human rights stuff made all the time. However, seeing Secretary of State Pompeo sitting down with a crown prince and smiling and laughing, to me, was appalling.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. Even if they want to pretend, they being the president and Pompeo, that it's not conclusive that they were in on the slaughter of Khashoggi. This is not a time for frivolity and back patting kind of thing. I was appalled by the behavior.
I know you're appalled, and as was I. So I just think everyone needs to sort of switch the lens a little bit, and because Pompeo would certainly know that you would be appalled, and a country that was serious about getting to the truth would have said to the Saudis, no press. We're meeting privately.
Oh, that's a very good point.
You are not going to have one of these royal fancy meet and greets. We are the United States of America, and we're doing it this way. So why didn't they? Because we're well past. They don't know what they're doing. And I think the only result or the only conclusion you can come to is they know that the Saudis are lying. So instead of wondering why, like, how come they're buying the Saudi story, they're not. They know the Saudis are lying. And in, you know, Donald Trump's binary transactional, there's no yesterday, there's no tomorrow view of the world, the most important thing is not some ideology of human rights and we're a moral country. It is whatever transaction he's protecting. Now, so once you get, okay, their line and the lie, right, this idea mm-hmm. that guilty till proven innocent, is just being perpetuated so that they can have some excuse, you know, to be able to move forward. So it's like Bill Clinton's, you know, sexual relations, you know, lie. Like, it's just you know it's a lie, but you're just saying it because you want an out at some stage. So the transaction that's being protected, the Trump administration will say it's the defense transactions. Most defense analysis thinks that's not. The Saudis are not going to the Chinese. I mean, let's just be clear here for 10,000 reasons, including the fact they've already invested in our affair. This isn't like, you know, widgets that you could just get them from anywhere. I think it's fair to ask, is that transaction that's being protected is, of course, the Saudi interest in both the Trump and Kushner campaigns and businesses.
Yeah, I mean, that's because I read a lot of stories about it, whether, you know, the $110 billion arms deal is a big deal, but not that big of a deal.
They need
us more than we need them. The oil issue isn't such a big deal because we're producing a lot
more
of oil here.
Now.
So it does seem that, and the president himself has made jokes about the Saudis buying up his apartments and spending lots of money, and there's been lots of reports they're spending money in his hotels. I mean, I don't know. It seems like it would be small change, but maybe it's a big deal.
So look, we need the kingdom, right? Because for a variety of dynamics, in the Middle East, we need the kingdom. We don't need this crown prince. And so two things I'm looking at for the week ahead is, and I'm, you know, said this publicly last night and on Twitter, you know, there is a two-star general who will be dead by the end of the weekend, right? This guy that, you know, they keep saying, oh, it's a two-star general who actually did this and he wasn't authorized, he was rogue. That general will be dead. And so in the same way we talk about dead Russians, we're going to start talking about dead Saudis. That team is not protected by the crown prince. The second thing I'm looking at is Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham was on Fox News yesterday talking about how the crown prince has made all these mistakes and we need Saudi Arabia, but we don't necessarily need him to be in charge. I cannot believe Lindsey Graham goes on Fox News and says that without some authority from the president himself. So,
meaning that he is going to go and be replaced by some other
crown prince.
Remember,
he was not supposed to be the crown prince. Yeah. I mean, that was a power struggle beyond all power struggles. He did, you know, and the only, you know, the reason why he felt empowered to do this is, of course, Jared Kushner and, you know, his relationship with the Trump family. He thought that the prince thought he could cross any line because Jared Kushner is going to protect him. And the question, where is Jared Kushner this week?
Well, reporter on the airplane, as we know, tried to ask him questions about Saudi Arabia and the Secret Service blocked the camera.
There's no public, there's nothing. I mean, Jared Kushner was our ambassador to Saudi Arabia. We don't have one. And so this is a whole big rigmarole to protect or to clean up the fact that Kushner is not sophisticated enough to both have an ally, but have an ally that is checked by American power. So instead, he says to the crown prince, you know, arrest all your brothers and cousins, you know, bomb in Yemen, you know, make the prime minister of Lebanon resign on air. Oh, all of that's fine. If you're the crown prince, why would you think this is a problem, right? or you're going to kill an American, not well, you know, well, a journalist.
You know what I also found fascinating? It's all the pictures they showed of the crown prince, with one of the alleged assassins standing next to him, sort of a bodyguard kind of mode. And then, as some commentator pointed out, what did he say? I see you later, Crown Prince. I got to go off for a few days.
Go listen to some music. go listen to some music in Turkey, as we now know.
So they put in background music. He's up to his eye teeth.
And I think what people are forgetting about this narrative, like, so anyway, if everyone could just get their head around, they know the Trump administration knows that the Saudis are lying. So all of this, you know, but what about this and what about that? Like, they know it's a lie. Like, there's no way anyone could look at this evidence. And the tell, right, has always been that Khashoggi went to the consulate in Istanbul and then was told to come back 24 hours later. So that's your tell, right? In other words, the idea that this wasn't a long-term strategy to when Khashoggi shows up, tell him to come back the next day, we're going to stick a dozen plus guys on an airplane with, you know, bone cutters or whatever they're called. So, you know, to me, it's once you're like everyone's lying, then it's like actually I stopped asking why.
You know, even if you're a Trump fan out there, we're 2 years in. Is it not time to acknowledge that despite what Nikki Haley and her her press conference where she announced she was stepping down at the end of the year the other day in the Oval Office said what a genius Kushner was. Does anybody believe, I don't care if he's the smartest kid on the planet, I don't care if he's got 100% confidence in the president of the United States, he has zero foreign policy experience except business foreign policy, foreign experience, and the notion that he would be put in charge of handling the most sensitive relationships and dealing with the most sensitive crisis, it is laughable if it wasn't deadly.
Yeah. And it's both.
In any case.
I agree with you.
We're talking to Julia Kayyem.
But look at who cleanup was, right? I mean, cleanup was not Jared jumping on a plane. Cleanup was
Pompeo.
And his career staff. I mean, in other words, this is all a show for cleanup of 2 years of acquiescence to the crown prince and the king. And the Trump administration knows that. So all they can do is, you know, publicly announce some skepticism about whether the Saudis do it. You know, privately, they know the Saudis.
But you know what?
They're not that stupid.
One last thing about this, by the way, every once in a while, you hope there's going to be bipartisanship on something other than, you know, some innocuous bill that gets 435 votes in the House. This is an area where a lot of Republicans are being really critical of the Saudis. You mentioned Lindsey Graham is one. Lindsey Graham is not alone. And the question is, are the Republicans going to be willing, as a matter of principle, to call out the leader of their party, the President of the United States, on a pretty critical issue?
So, I get, you know, they're always going to show concern and whatever. I mean, that's why I think the Lindsey Graham statement is really significant.
You think he was like a surrogate, essentially,
for Lindsey
Trump.
I think Lindsey Graham was saying to the king, not the royal prince, we're going to have a political problem if the crown prince is still in charge. And so I think it's going to be a really crazy weekend. I think, you know, as I said, dead Saudis are the new dead Russians. I think, you know, and whether the crown prince goes away willingly. But that, to me, Lindsey Graham does not say that casually.
Okay, let's move on to something else. Everybody knows about the terrible problem with the children being separated from their families at the borders.
Still 250
of them. 250 of them. And the majority of them apparently are not going to ever be reunited, at least in the near future, with their parents. 175 of those parents have been deported. They also say 125 don't want their children reunited with them. I'm not sure if that's true or not true.
If they understood.
But in any case, they seem to be gearing up for a second.
Yeah.
Let's separate everybody.
Let's do it again. That was so fun the first time. Stephen Miller is the president's immigration advisor, who essentially has taken immigration and border enforcement from the agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and sort of running policy and operations from the White House that has been so successful between the Muslim ban and the family separations. I mean, those have both been such disasters. But that disruption that separates the Trump base from the rest of us, and right, the Trump base is you know, never going to move, is exactly what they want. So why not do it again? You know, one has to think that the Trump White House's closing argument going into November is we're going to restart a family separation program. So just two things on this. So the first is just let's just deal with facts, because all of us can get very emotional about this and whatever. Like, you know, in the scheme of things, you know, what was this? So what we do know, and so we got the facts on our side in terms of those of us who oppose family separation, is that it did not serve as a deterrent in the period it was in place, right, between March and September. In fact, numbers went up. And so Trump sort of shows his hand when he says things like, we're going to go back to family separation because they keep coming. They keep coming. You're like, obviously, because there's no link between the conduct here and what causes people to move, right? Because they're facing their own deadly choice. The second thing is obviously what this new program will look like. And one suspected that was always what they had intended to do, but just weren't smart enough to do it at the front, which is you basically give what they're calling it the binary choice option. You give families an option. So you keep them together when they're detained and you say, okay, here's your option. And because you could keep them up for 20 to 30 days, here's your option. You apply for asylum and we separate you from your kids, and good luck if you get it, right? So they're allowed to apply for asylum, or you give up your asylum and we'll send you back, no harm, no foul, with your kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the binary choice.
Okay.
And basically you've completely negated any notion of asylum law in this country, right? But just by saying, I mean, who is going to take that choice?
But why would you do this at this point, since a lot of Republicans even were very upset about the family separation deal? I mean, there was a pretty broad consensus that this was a bad idea.
So,
I mean,
you can just say ideology, that Stephen Miller and that gang just believes, right? So despite the data, just believes that the more that you know, as I often say, you know, cruelty is the feature, not the bug. In other words, they will say the cruelty of this program is the policy, because the crueler you are, the less likely it is that parents will put their children into that. But the data is not proving that. Well, so that's what I think. I mean, the other is, of course, not everyone opposed it, right? And the more that you can say that we are a country under siege by 5-year-olds coming over, you know, with their families, and we have to detain them, the more you galvanize the immigration issue.
Okay, we're out of time, so this is going to be a yes or no. Things are they getting the help they need in Florida? Sounds like they're not, from FEMA.
No.
Very quick. Okay, no.
Next
time we'll go
We'll start with that.
Our national security expert, Juliet Kayyem, joins us every week. She's on the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School. She's an analyst for CNN and CEO of Zemcar. Thank you very much, Juliet. We're going to go to Pledge. And when we get back from Pledge, we get a new NOVA documentary looking at the cutting-edge work of doctors and scientists as they explore how addiction affects the brain. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Easy access to prescription painkillers like OxyContin is exacerbating the deadliest epidemic of addiction in U.S. history, with overdose being the number one cause of death for people under 50. But our response to this, which for years seems to have been a combination of moral shaming and 12-step programs, is out of step with the underlying causes of addictive behavior.
Individuals struggling with addiction are actually battling millions of years of evolution, because our brains are exquisitely evolved to seek rewards.
That's from a new NOVA documentary. It's called Addiction, which looks at the latest work that doctors and scientists are doing to effectively treat a condition that they're approaching as a chronic disease, not as a moral failing. It airs tonight at 9 on GBH2. Joining us to talk about this is Sarah Holt. Sarah is the producer, director, and writer of NOVA's Addiction. Sarah, it's good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Laura Kehoe practices addiction medicine. She's the medical director for the Bridge Clinic, both at MGH. Doctor, it's good to see you, too. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, let's start with you. What were you trying to do here?
Well, I was hoping that I could help people understand how chronic drug abuse actually alters the brain. Because I would have people say to me, I could stop smoking cigarettes. Why can't they just stop using opioids? And I'd say, well, you've never gone through acute opioid withdrawal. You feel like you're dying. And I feel like so many people don't understand that at a certain point, people who've crossed that line into addiction are using just to feel normal, not to be sick.
You know, I told both of you when I met you before you were on TV the other night that no one knows less about science and is more scared of science than I am. I understand none of it. It is the single best 60-minute explanation of the science of addiction that I've ever seen or read in my life. So let me tell you, it's huge. You make the point, too, Dr. Kehoe, is how treatable this illness is. Fill in the blanks on that for us a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So in medicine, we take care of many illnesses, many chronic, meaning we don't have cures for them, but we have excellent treatments to help people get in control of it or in remission. And really good analogies for substance use disorders or diabetes or heart disease or asthma, because I think people can relate to that a little bit better. And if we compare and contrast those illnesses, actually a little known secret is that addiction rates of remission are actually higher than those for heart disease, asthma, and diabetes, if people get the right care. And the right care really includes largely opioid agonist treatment, which I'm happy to talk about.
What does that mean?
Opioid agonist treatment includes methadone and Suboxone, and really individualized care. And what that means is, again, looking to the type of care that any of us would want to have, it places the patient at the center of the treatment team. It balances the competing priorities in the patient's life. And we work in very flexible models to actually meet their needs. And at times when the illness is active, we kind of hone in on that and we provide more support and keep that trust alive and stick with the patient, knowing that there's not a kind of exit off the highway, but it's a circuitous route. And we stick with them. We may include a really important support for them. We didn't talk much about it last night, but peer recovery coaches have really transformed the type of care that we're providing people. And these are people who are in recovery themselves and meeting people where they are and partnering with the patient and with the providers to help them to navigate many other issues in their lives that may be affecting their health.
But you know, this,
Sarah,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, that, and by the way, we're talking about the new NOVA documentary, Addiction. Sarah, you mentioned the thing about people thinking that like they could quit cigarettes, they can quit opioids. But talk about the brain disorder part, because I think most of us don't get that.
I think one of the most interesting things to me with addiction is a lot of people will look at someone lying on the street and think, why can't they just motivate? Why can't they get up, go to work, get a job? And if you realize one of the key things that all drugs do to the brain, you know, addictive drugs, is they flood the brain with dopamine. It's one of the most important neurotransmitters in our brain. Dopamine is what is released when we eat, we fall in love. It's essential for our survival. It's essential for us to have motivation. And the brain desperately is trying to regain its balance. And so when you flood the brain with dopamine, I mean, up to 10 times more, the body then cuts it back.
And that's the key, I think, because a lot of people would say, oh, well, we're about to have legalized marijuana. People get a good reinforcement from that. But there's not the 10 times, there's not, what's the difference, basically?
Well,
or between liquor that people like to have a beer or a scotch and get a buzz from that. Why is this different?
Well, I think that anything highly rewarding will flood the brain with dopamine.
Right.
And it could be 2 to 10 times more than normal rewards. Opiates tend to be very high up there in terms of the amount of dopamine released. And your body stops making dopamine. So when you cross that line into addiction, you don't have enough dopamine.
You know, the person that just totally blew, well, there are a number of people in this documentary who blew me away. This guy, Jason Edwards, who is a coal miner in West Virginia, spent a lot of time in a part of West Virginia. His name is Jason Edwards. Just listen to him, this brief little clip on his personal fight with addiction.
My wife at the time went and seen her sister for 9 days, and I spent $21,000 while she was gone on pain medicine. I did lose my job. I didn't care. Only thing I cared about was that magical date on the calendar when I went back to the doctor.
He was almost like a poet, by the way. The more he spoke through this thing, it was just unbelievable. Yeah. You know, obviously what you guys are trying to break through, to me at least in this documentary, is the pathetic lack of information. Maybe even if it's not, you know, malevolence, but lack of information, misunderstanding, and the stigma stuff. We talked about this the other night, too. The stigma is so intense. We, you know, the former police chief in Gloucester was here with John Rosenthal ages ago when they talked about, we got to deal with this as a public health, not a public safety matter. Intellectually, people get it. But Is information enough, doctor, in your estimation, to break through the stigma that appears to be everywhere because there's so much fear and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think we've made many strides in terms of anti-stigma campaign and education, but we have a long way to go. And I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head. We've partnered with on the front lines with the police and firefighters and helping to revive people. And we've done a good job of explaining the science of addiction. And I still think, you know, I often say, you know, it's a 21st century. We have decades of research. We have decades of data on the science that this is a brain disease. We have decades of data on the medications that work for this and on behavioral interventions that work. And yet we're still having to kind of make our point for this. And so stigma is alive and well, and it's one of the biggest things that prevents people from engaging in care. Stigma comes also from within. People feel that they're not worthy of treatment because they, quote, did this to themselves because they don't understand what's going on in their body. Why do I keep going back to using, as he said? And so those behavioral manifestations of untreated illness are still so difficult to explain and to understand. And again, it has to do with the organ that is affected by this illness is one that controls our behaviors. And the part of the brain that controls behaviors is very altered by the substance.
Well, Dr. Kehoe, there's a lot of ignorance among your fellow doctors, too. You mm-hmm. had this great illustration of this young woman that was injured, I think, in a sports injury, and she was given opioids, and then she's sent home, and she's still in huge pain. I think she described it as it felt like her bones were coming out of her body.
Right.
She was apparently in withdrawal,
right.
and when they took her back to the hospital,
yep.
they didn't recognize right. that or understand that. I mean,
because medical schools don't even teach this, right?
Yes.
I mean,
well,
most medical schools don't even teach addiction, do they?
Correct. And now we're working actually diligently to expand the treatment. So we've got a couple of wonderful things that are going on. One is we're having young student doctors, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, social workers, people who want to get involved in this and want to learn more about it. And I think that's reflective of the anti-stigma campaign that we've done, which is great. And we have medical schools, and I can tell you at Harvard Medical School, expanding the curriculum and starting in the first year of bringing patients in to explain, patients in recovery with one of us to explain what their experience was, how they got better, and also having a full curriculum started in medical school and throughout residency. And so that's actively being continued and expanded. And it's critical because we all graduated from medical school with limited to no education about that. The other piece is at the same time we have physicians and nurse practitioners who are actively in practice who are really trying to change the culture. And so it's not just about learning how to prescribe Suboxone or how to refer someone to methadone. It's how that care is delivered and that it's delivered in a patient-centered, compassionate, immediately accessible pattern. And it's meeting the patients where they are and helping them to be involved in their treatment like every other treatment.
We're talking about the new Nova documentary, Addiction, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on WGBH Channel 2. We're going to keep talking about it after this brief break. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's time to support Boston Public Radio on WGBH. Listener contributions pay for the program and keep it on the air. You don't have to give much to make a difference. Please make a difference by calling 888-897-9424 or give online at wgbhnews.org.
You know, as I said before, Marjorie and I have each of our favorite thank you gifts. Yesterday, Marjorie was like over the moon about that, whatever it was, emergency preparedness
kit,
which was great.
It was
but
great.
I didn't love it as much as she did. I liked it. I love today's thing, maybe because I already have one and know how great it is. This is a new wireless phone charger. That's the thank you gift if you give $10 a month. It's got the 89.7 WGBH logo on it. It's a little disc, lightweight, white. It's got the, again, the logo, as I said. And what you do is you just put your lay your phone on top of it. You don't have to, you know, do it perfectly. You just lay it on top of it. You power your phone and I guess you power us with a gift of just $10 a month as a sustaining member. The deadline for the charger, by the way, is 7. If you want to make Marjorie happy, you should give before 2 because theoretically there's some competition that I'm not aware of between the shows, but Marjorie says there is. The number is 888-897-9424. WGBH.org. By the way, the deadline's at 7, which is exactly when the debate starts.
That's
the gubernatorial
right.
debate that would not happen were it not for your contributions.
You know, by the way, do you leave your little portable charger in the same place all the time?
No, I have a couple, actually. I have a couple, yeah.
Okay. Because I was thinking it would help you not lose your phone if you have a portable charger and just put it right down on top of
the that's a good point,
You know what I mean? If you leave it in the room with your computer or if you leave it in the room, the kitchen or whatever it is. But anyway, it's a neat little thing. And it does mean a lot to us that you guys take the time out of your busy day, busy schedule to contribute, to give what you can to WGBH. The Sustainer deal is a big deal because it's not so much out of your pocketbook, but it helps us plan our schedule. We have 24/7. We're on the air all day, all night, 7 days a week with great stuff, morning edition, evening, afternoon edition, you know, all the shows. So it really means a lot to us. $10 a month will get you this great little charger, wireless charger that Jim talks about he's so happy with. And that is only available until, as Jim said, 7 o'clock tonight. We begin the debate, and I'm now, as I said, up to 1.5 questions. The number is 888-897.
Don't do this. I can't stand the email. It's like everybody thinks you're telling the truth.
24 or WGBH.org.
Lori in South Boston, thank you. Randall in Rochester, thank you. Elizabeth, somewhere in Colorado, I can't read where, but we're glad you contributed. Thanks for listening. And Carolyn Worcester, thank you. It's easy. And by the way, this is really fast. It doesn't take like 20 minutes out of your day. It takes a few minutes. You either do it on the phone, 888-897-9424. Give what you can. If you want to do 10 bucks a month, that pays for the wireless phone charger. If you can do 100 bucks a month, even better. Or go to WGBH.org. What are you laughing about?
Carolyn wants to know my rationing at 1.75 questions. I'm not allowed any follow-up. Or do those count towards my allocation? We're still negotiating that, Carolyn. Thanks for asking. Paul says I should get twice as many questions since Jim is probably going to interrupt me in the middle of all my questions anyway.
I may. 888-897-9424. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about a new Nova documentary. It'll air tonight. It's called Addiction at 9 o'clock. Marjorie and I saw it. It is spectacular. Sarah Holtz here. She's the producer, director, and writer of Addiction. Dr. Laura Kehoe is in it quite a bit. She practices addiction medicine at MGH. She's at Harvard Medical School, too, all those things.
So we're going to hear about what you can do to treat this terrible disease in a second. But I wanted to just touch base with Sarah on the story of a young man whose parents were on the, his mother's on the internet, like desperately looking for a place to send her son. Many people talked about the incredible cost of the treatments. But tell us the story a little bit about that family and how the son fared.
Well, Admiral Winnefeld was on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, really a military strategist who never thought. He told me this was the hardest battle he ever had to fight trying to save his son. And to me, his mother going on the internet, it's something that happens to millions of families across this country trying to navigate a very broken system of care. If their son had had cancer, someone would have been telling them, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. There would have been a whole plan. She was left on her own. They paid for the treatment out of pocket, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, within a month after he was out, he's dead of a heroin fentanyl overdose.
It was
right
most
after
powerful
he left
about
for
that.
College,
I'm sorry.
Right
just
after
a
he,
few days, yeah.
Yeah, wasn't it? He goes off to college. They take him to college. Everything's great. And she gets a phone call 2 or 3 days later. Yeah. Your son is gone.
You know, it's like you think after 15 months he went to an abstinence-based treatment program and, you know, he was completely isolated and he came out and everyone thought he's cured. But, you know, addiction is a chronic disease and the cravings that occur in this disease are overwhelming. They can come back years long after drug use. The memories stay there. You never forget addictive behavior.
I want to get back to the cravings in a second, what you're doing about the cravings at MGH. Mm-hmm. But I know you know this, but for those who haven't seen it yet, the reason why it was so brilliant to choose this family, in my estimation, is because everybody thinks it's those people, whoever they are. It's those people. This guy is one of the most powerful people in the military. They had access to everything and anything, and she's sitting on the computer, no insurance, no idea where to go. It's just so brilliantly captured, in my estimation, the plight that every parent, rich, poor, powerful, unpowerful, not powerful, has. So let's go to what you're doing instead of just whining about the negatives, which is what Marjorie and I do for a living virtually all the time. Tell us what they're doing at MGH that should be done elsewhere. What are the things, what's the solution to this other than education?
So really, it sounds like it's very innovative, and in terms of addiction treatment, it is. But again, looking through the lens of other chronic illnesses, it partners beautifully with what we do for every other medical illness we treat. So we have, if somebody is admitted to the hospital for a substance-related illness or they're found to have a substance use disorder, we have an inpatient addiction consult team. Again, the analogy is somebody's admitted with a heart attack, you'll see a general internal medicine team, but also a cardiologist specialist will come and be involved. Here, an addiction specialist team that could be a nurse practitioner, one of our medical doctors, social worker will come, meet the patient, and use that moment as a reachable moment, whether they're interested in treatment or not, to start talking about what their goals of care are, what they know about. At that point, if they have an opioid use disorder, we're very aggressive about starting medication on them to both help the cravings that drive ongoing use, to prevent people from using in the hospital or overdosing in the hospital. Many people are left to have to treat the withdrawal themselves if they're not treated with medications like Suboxone or methadone. And it helps to treat whatever illness, keep them in the hospital to get that illness treated. We found, though, we do a good job at the inpatient unit level and needed a place to have people go immediately post-discharge, because that's when people fall through the cracks. And as we know, there are long waits for long-term treatment in the community. So that's where the Bridge Clinic came to be born. And what that is that immediate access, low threshold, meaning people can come as they are. If they're actively using, if they're ambivalent about what they want to do, we're going to just have them come as they are, meet them where they are.
If they've been treated and have a relapse, take it. You don't say no.
Don't say no. You come in. They can come in impaired. They can come in not knowing anything. It's a walk-in. We also do scheduled appointments. And when they come in there, they meet with a physician. They meet with a recovery coach, a peer who can support them. We have groups, optional. Everything is optional. Nothing is mandated. And again, starting with the patient where they can meet. We're not saying you need to see a therapist first. You need to prove to us that you're ready to go, and then you'll get this carrot of life-saving medication. It's flipping that on its head to meet the illness and to prevent prevent overdoses and to keep people engaged in care. We also do harm reduction work. So if we have people, the natural history of this illness is for people to actively use, especially early on. And so we talk about harm reduction. We give safe injection kits. We talk about how they can keep safe. And not only is that a tool to help prevent spreading infection or them getting sick, it's also a tool for them to say, this person really understands this illness, and I'm going to go back because I trust that they're going to help take care of me.
Can we stay on the safe injection kit for a second? One of the great controversies in this country is about these safe injection sites. We've talked about it on the show. Mm-hmm. You address it. Talk about true believers. This guy, Darwin Fisher from Vancouver, is otherworldly. He's the program coordinator at something called Insight in Vancouver. I assume most people know. It's the first legal supervised drug injection site in North America. And he talks here in your film about how safe injection sites help people with addiction. Here it is.
When people come to Insight, often the first thing that they're thinking is, I need a safer place to use. I don't want to die in the alley. I'm tired of living in essentially what are third world conditions. So what we're doing is we're saying, come on into first world healthcare. And in the years since Insights opened, overdoses in the area have gone down, and our HIV rate in Vancouver has plummeted dramatically.
The data's there, but virtually nobody has the courage to follow their lead. Is that political fear? Is it what is it?
For one reason, it's illegal in the United States, and the FBI has come out and
said. Well, so is marijuana illegal nationally, and they're doing that.
They would arrest people if they opened up supervised injection sites. And the thing is that the New York Times reported that in the month of August, 160,000 needles were collected off the streets in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. You know, you go to Vancouver and, you know, the needles have disappeared. You still see them, but they're not the level of needles because people are going into these sites, they're getting clean needles, they're being disposed of properly. The other thing that amazed me is if someone starts to have an overdose, no one's ever died in these sites, there's instant help. And when I was out on the streets of Vancouver waiting for EMS crews to come because there'd been an overdose, it would sometimes take 10 minutes. I mean, you're talking about brain damage when someone is unconscious that long.
You know, one of the things I think I know, and you guys straighten me out from a little I know about opioid addiction, is that relapses is almost part of the disease, that people that can be 5 years out or 10 years out, and you know, that there's a lot of shame associated with that. But apparently that's, I don't know if that's different than alcoholics or what.
You know, the thing that makes me so sad is that a lot of times someone will relapse and they'll say the treatment doesn't work, Suboxone doesn't work. Or, you know, parents will like feel like they have to kick their kids out of the house. And that's the point when people need the help the most. They need people to rally around them and help them cut the relapse short and get them back on track.
And 12 steps is not effective for opioids?
So in isolation, 12-step is not effective. So anything without a comprehensive, you know, there's a continuum, and I wanted to make that clear, that not to disparage 12-step. 12-step has saved many people's lives in terms of breaking isolation, helping with peer support. Yep. As I said earlier, this is an illness of isolation and deep shame. The controversy is that 12-step historically has said that they don't feel that medication should be part of the intervention. And that's a problem. And it can depend on which meeting people go to. Some are more open to it than others. And there have been times, and I've had many patients who have been shamed off of their medication, saying, when are you going to get truly sober, and actually have overdosed, and I've had two who have died in that setting. So it's a continuum. They are not mutually exclusive. They both complement each other if done in the right way, but if one is pitting against the other, and likewise, if people who are on medication and they shame people for going to 12-step, that's not good either. It has to be individualized, and peer support can come in one-to-one. It doesn't have to be groups. Many people don't feel comfortable in groups. So.
That's the voice of Dr. Laura Kehoe, practices addiction medicine at MGH, and the other person here is Sarah Holt, is the woman behind Nova's documentary airing tonight at 9, addiction. I operate under the assumption that insurance companies only do whatever they do if it helps the bottom line. And I naively, apparently, believe that if they actually covered all this treatment, it would help the bottom line because you're avoiding even worse consequences. Obviously, I'm wrong somewhere in this mix because insurance, for the most part, doesn't cover this stuff. So where's the disconnect? Where am I making a mistake, Sarah?
Well, I think it's beginning to change. I think increasingly insurance companies are stepping up to the plate, like especially in Massachusetts. But, you know, most families that are sending their patients to these expensive inpatient programs that can be $30,000 a month, $45,000 a month, they're paying out of pocket.
And most of those programs, I would argue, and we know, are not evidence-based practice.
Great series in the Globe, by the way, recently about some of those things. Yeah.
Correct. And so, you know, paying for a place that looks wonderful and is, and I'm sure they're treated very compassionately, but doesn't provide what we know is scientifically proven is, and we see people who have very poor outcomes.
Okay, so we only have a minute left. You each get 30 seconds. You're the czar of this issue in America. What's the one most important thing that should change in this country to get us where we want to be?
We need more flexible care models that provide comprehensive care that meets people where they are.
What would you say, Sarah?
Well, I would agree with that. I think we should have treatment on demand. It should be evidence-based, and your insurance should pay for it. And addiction needs to be part of the medical system, treated like any other medical illness.
Let me tell you, if we get there, it's in great part because of the work you guys did
in
this film.
It is. There's a great line in your film, I think, where someone said, you should be able to walk into your doctor's office, say, I'm addicted, I need help, and get it. Mm. That would be a wonderful thing. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good to see you both.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
I appreciate
it. It was great.
We were talking about Sarah Holt, the new documentary, Addiction. Sarah Holt is the producer, director, and writer of Nova's Addiction. Dr. Laura Kehoe practices addiction medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Addiction by Nova airs tonight at 9 o'clock right here on WGBH Channel 2. You can always learn more about Nova online at pbs.org. Sarah Holt and Dr. Laura Kehoe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For joining us. Coming up, how the era of Trump is giving rise to corporate activism. Are CEOs joining the resistance out of principle or for profit? Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane joins us for that. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marge Regan. The Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United essentially gave corporations the same rights as people to spend money in elections. Critics described it as a hostile corporate takeover of our democratic process. Today, in the era of Trump, some corporations are trying to defend the democratic process, or so they say. From the CEO of Levi's fighting for gun reform to companies like Lyft working to increase voter turnout, corporate activism was on the rise. So is this out of principle? Or is the motivation profit, and does it even matter? Joining us for a take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy's the holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hi there, Nancy.
Hey there.
So what is going on, Nancy?
So this, so what's going on, dear listeners, is that a host of companies, Walmart, Patagonia, Lyft, Levi Strauss, and others, coming from the CEO's office, have launched Get Out the Vote campaigns among their employees and their customers. And it's more than just admonition. It's more than let's go vote, exercise your democratic right and privilege and duty. It's also, you know, in some cases, scheduling time, closing business so people can go vote, because scheduling is often given as a reason that people don't vote. So less than 40% of eligible voters voted in the midterms in 2014. So I believe that's 2014, not 16. So these are citizens, and I mean, these are leaders saying we have an obligation, and they're all saying basically the same thing. Something we also heard something from another corporate leader in a couple of weeks ago named Seth Klarman, who Bostonians know is the head of Baupost, a very successful hedge fund, located here in Boston. He, like these CEOs, is talking about being worried about democracy, the vulnerability of our system. And they are moving. They are not the first to do this under the Trump administration, not the first leaders. They are moving further and further along the spectrum from the bystander role that business has generally assumed vis-a-vis the political arena to public actor. And so here's the latest salvo, if you will, or latest step along that journey. And they're vocal and they're serious. And it is not partisan in the case of these efforts to bring out the vote.
Okay, color me dubious, I think we should say. So Walmart all of a sudden had an epiphany and decided that greater participation in small d democracy is important for our society, or what motivated it? It sounds so selfless on its face, and there's very little selfless that comes out of publicly traded entities, I think it's fair to say. So what's this about?
So I don't know, Jim, to be really candid. This one's a little harder to ferret out in terms of what are the ulterior and slightly potentially darker motives, if you will.
If there are any.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know whether there are. I don't know. So when I say relative to, say, corporate action on gun safety in the wake of Parkland, you'll remember Dick's Sporting Goods, Walmart, yep, all these companies saying we're not going to sell automatic or semi-automatic weapons, or Ken Frazier, the CEO of Merck, stepping off one of the president's business roundtables or councils, and then a host of people following him in the wake of Charlottesville last year, or go back,
or Martin Shkreli for prison reform, for example. No, I'm kidding. That was a joke. I'm sorry.
Well, but this guy Seth Klarman that you mentioned before, I read
he's more transparent.
Yeah,
where
I think so too.
He is used to be a Republican. Used to be the Republican.
Has been a Republican for
donor,
a long time,
and he's in favor of what the president has done in terms of taxes. But he's very upset about other things.
He's also upset about the deficit of the repercussions of the tax bill.
So he's a billionaire, and he's given $20 million to Democrats, not necessarily because he's in favor of everything the Democrats do, but he doesn't like the president.
Anyone, he said, who thinks that policies like that are pro-business, you know, reducing regulation, giving big tax breaks to corporations, anyone thinks that that is not ultimately a slide or a step toward a cliff that is very dangerous, he said, is fooling themselves.
So, but can we say, but so the difference, you two, is Klarman, I get totally, an individual or a business says, I want to take partisan action because I think the Democrats are horrible, or I think the Republicans are horrible. I can't stand Trump's temperament. That makes sense to me.
Right.
And by the way, in this history, you and I have discussed this, Marjorie, when businesses in Massachusetts, when I used to do ballot campaigns, would get really upset they couldn't get the legislature to do something. They raised $2 million, put a question on the ballot, and they essentially bought a law that saved them, I think, that year in $400 million in taxes. That I get. What I don't get is the public spiritedness of these businesses, okay, and maybe it is, who are not taking partisan action theoretically as a result of it, but have just decided that it is part of the public good that all of their employees' work.
Okay,
you know?
So let's turn to that. So Klarman is a more specific example.
Right.
And by the way, his idea isn't the Democrats are great. His idea is we need to check on the runaway
right.
Trump train. Okay, so let's look. My theory on this, Jim, and again, it's a theory. I don't have the evidence.
Well, I don't either.
To really corroborate this, but we've talked about this also in these same kinds of conversations about growing and now I think unstoppable business political activism. Remember, you have a consuming body politic out there, particularly young people, but increasingly people of lots of different age groups and demographic groups and income classes who now are thinking about consumption as a way of exercising social and political opinion and priority. So we can go back to the boycott Ivanka Trump.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Campaign at the beginning of Trump's presidency in which Nordstrom and other companies pulled her goods. We can think about lots of different examples where companies have gotten into the fray, political fray, and consumers have reacted. And what we are learning about the newest generation of young, active, you know, information-hungry consumers, which we're now calling Generation Z, dear listeners. This is after millennials, and these are people born in the, you know, kind of the late 1990s through the early aughts, the mid-1990s through the early aughts, is they care very much about the stand of companies on social and political issues, particularly how they see the purpose of their business in relation to the burning issues of the day. So, Jim, is it possible that they're also thinking, we want to stand for something mm-hmm. that's, you know, red, white, and blue and noble or honorable? And not necessarily easily perceived as partisan, that may indeed be a piece of it, right? Or are they the best, what is it, the best defense is a good fast offense?
Yeah.
Are they, in the case of Walmart, for example, right, trying in some ways to foster or build a nicer, more socially conscious reputation than the one they perceive that they have among a certain group of important consumers?
By the way, I'm just looking at the list. The thing is called, as you said, Time to Vote.
Mm-hmm.
And you look, it's got 150 corporations signed up as of today. It includes the Abercrombie & Fitch's, Eileen Fisher. I'm just randomly looking down this list. A lot of Kaiser Permanente, which, you know, Lyft, as you said, Gap.
Patagonia.
Yeah. Well, they're, PayPal. That's not the first time for them.
And so it's interesting. But by the way, and you know, if it turns out more people vote, you know, it's almost like who gives a damn? You know, they can advance their agenda. People are free to make whatever decision they want with their vote. But if it produces more people turning out, go get them.
Well, let's move on to the big oil companies.
Yeah, so
Exxon, Chevron, and Occidental Petroleum, among them. Apparently, they are no longer denying climate change. They're going to keep making fossil fuel while slowing global warming. Activists say that's impossible. But they seem to be moving away from a, you know, the president said that we're open for drilling all around the coastline of the United States. We're going to talk to where they are going to be drilling in some national parks in a second. But I don't think Exxon, Chevron, Occidental, et cetera, have taken up on that, have they?
The answer is I don't know. But, dear listeners, this is a really interesting article, so let me commend it to you. And you might not find it by just a real quick Google search. It's by a gentleman named Chris Tomlinson, spelled just like it sounds, from the Houston Chronicle, September 24th of this year. Oil companies must put their policies where their marketing materials are. So the first part of the article is about the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative and some interesting investments on a relatively small scale in different ways to think about fossil fuels and mitigating or lowering climate damage or climate impact. Then, dear listeners, you get to the second half of the story, which is about the extremely large investments that these same companies have made in the camp to the political campaigns of senators and who question the reality of climate change, to the most recent Trump initiative to minimize fuel efficiency standards for cars, and investments in money to support the president's leaving the Paris Climate Agreement. So we got these
schizophrenic
or massively hypocritical.
Okay.
If you'll forgive me being so blunt. On the one hand, we have a global gas and oil climate initiative. On the other hand, we're actually really putting our money behind really trying to take fossil fuels out into fifth gear on our vulnerable global environmental highway, so to speak. So let's take this all with a great big grain of salt, folks.
You know what's amazing?
This is not real.
Basically, we're sitting here waiting for our coastlines to be wiped away. Mm-hmm. I mean, when do people say enough is enough? You know, it's just incredible.
But let me explain at least my take, which I think is fairly obvious. So the difference between the time to vote people, the Walmarts, the Lyfts, the Patagonians in this fossil fuel coalition. The time to vote thing I just don't get unless, as you're saying, Nancy, they think it'll appeal to the younger customer that they're becoming, you know, small D Democratic. The other thing is so ridiculously obvious to me is you have two choices. The train is leaving the station despite Donald Trump. You can either allow the train, if you're Exxon, Chevron, and Occidental, go to a station where you do not exist, or you direct it to a station where you do exist and mitigate what they would consider the radicalism of the climate change people. So we pretend we are concerned about climate change while at the same time muting the movement
so
we don't lose our whole
industry.
But
at the same time, there are very smart people who work for these oil companies. Rex Tillerson recognized that climate change was...
Oh, he was a really good Secretary of State, too.
Well, he wasn't a really good Secretary of State, but I'm pointing out that when he was the head of Exxon, the biggest oil company in the world, he recognized that climate change was man-made and was coming. So unless they want to... Because sooner or later, people will catch on as the coastlines are... obliterated.
And they want to make sure it's later.
No, they do want to make sure it's later, but I think they also want to make sure that they're in the clean energy business.
Of course.
So that they can
of course.
Not, that Exxon can exist in some other format down the road. I just don't.
Although, to that point, Marjorie, we now have evidence, a lot, very good evidence, and that the big oil companies, certainly Exxon, knew about the climate change and where it was taking the world 30 years ago.
In the 70s.
In the 70s. And they made General Motors and fuel-efficient cars in 1970, they took no action. So
no, it's worse than that. If you read the LA Times story, Bill McKibben is the one who turned us on to it. They lied. In fact, there's litigation around it now. I think Maura Healey's involved in this, about them, like the cigarette companies, lying about what they knew the impact of climate change was, like the tobacco companies lied about what they knew the impact of nicotine was, cigarette smoking.
But I would say we are at the state in climate change when people started to acknowledge that people were dying by the thousands of lung cancer from cigarettes. And people
We are there. We're just reaching the tipping point.
Wait a second. We're reaching the tipping point and we elected a person who says that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese?
Well, once again,
How does that fit into we're at the tipping point? You two,
I've said it for the 9 millionth time. He was running against Hillary Clinton, the second most popular person ever to run for president, besides Donald Trump. That's right, and he was promising to be a populist.
And she won the popular vote, and he won the electoral college.
And we have yet to see how much the Russians had to do with his winning at all.
Yeah. So it's a complicated.
But the point is, he got a lot of votes. By the way, if you want to be nostalgic, I'm sure you're thinking about this. Remember Mitt Romney? Remember the guy who's about to be a U.S. senator? He's running for president in 2011, and he's at the Iowa State Fair. Let's go back to those thrilling days of yesteryear. Here he is.
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on... Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes? Whose pockets? People's pockets. Okay, human beings, my friend.
You know, I remember him saying, I don't remember the blowback. This is like Trump at the UN yesterday. That was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, so let's get, there's another great story here, Nancy Kane, and this is about this this huge national park out in Utah, Hell's Backbone Grill.
It's about Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, and how the Trump administration under people like... Zinka, the Secretary of the Interior, have decided to cut these national monuments in half.
Right.
So that's going to be tied up in court for a while.
Drill.
So the oil and gas companies can drill. And there's a wonderful story, dear listeners, by Sarah Ventiera, Ventiera, July 30th, 2018. It's an NPR story, but it's online and it's a great written story about two restaurateurs, these two women who own what sounds like a great I guess we would say prairie to table, mountain to table restaurant.
Oh my God, it looks like a magical place.
It looks amazing. Yeah, it does. This restaurant they own where they serve things like Juniper Land Pozole, whatever that is, and grilled pork chops with Boulder. This is Boulder, Utah, crab apple barbecue sauce.
Chef Southwest by James Beard.
Yeah, James.
Nominated. I mean, right. I don't mean to take anything away. They've had two nominations.
Well, they were best chef semifinalists.
But this is a very famous, the point, it's half make lick your chops kind of food.
Literally.
The article, and half about these women as activists, because they are trying, along with a lot of other people in the region and some people who are welcoming the fracking and the jobs and the energy companies, they are trying very hard to stop this, to stop the dismemberment of, you know, one of the great and irreplaceable resources of our country, you know, a national monument in the land and wildlife around it. They're trying to stop that. And so it's an article both about their restaurant as a beacon of activism and great food and good conversation, and what it feels like on the ground in these places where 7 months of a year, the tourism from a national monument is a big, big deal, but where for 5 months of a year, there's not as much economic activity. So it's a really interesting article about the way that activism in business is taking place on a smaller scale and a less obvious scale or a less obvious plateau, no pun intended, than, say, the corporate the C-suites of large corporations.
You're so cynical today, Jim. Nancy and I are trying to keep hope alive here, and you're stepping on our toes.
May I just say one more thing on this broad level about, because this is a subject I really am engrossed in, and it's fascinating as a historian of leadership, because this is not the way it worked 10 years ago. It's not the way it worked when Milton Friedman said, you know, buy low and sell high, and your obligations to your shareholders, end of sentence, end of paragraph, end of subject. End of discussion. So I'm fascinated by this. But I think there's one other thing. I went back and watched the Dream Crazy video with Colin Kaepernick. That's a 2-minute video that he made for Nike. If you haven't seen it, dear listeners, it is an astounding piece of advertising videography. And he's very good and he narrates, but it's not really about Colin Kaepernick at all. It's about Dream Crazy. It's about just what it says. And I thought to myself, Nike, and by the way, Nike sales are up 31% over the relevant quarter last year after they started running the ad. So it's getting a lot of traction for all the people that alienated. It brought more people into the Nike fold. And I thought to myself, Jim, what if it is now becoming the case that taking a stand, however neutral, small d, however neutral, is embracing someone who's very controversial within the NFL. I think this courageous young man, Colin Kaepernick, who's now jobless, right? What if that's now becoming table stakes or in beginning to be the cost of entry?
No, I believe that.
In certain markets, in certain places. That, my dear friends, my fellow citizens, is absolutely brand new turf. And for some of us who study this stuff, it is absolutely revolutionary in the context of the history of American business and its leadership.
Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us every week. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her new book is Forged in Crisis: The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Coming up, time for another edition of The Afternoon Zoo with Cy Montgomery. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. It's time for the Afternoon Zoo with Cy Montgomery, where we look at the intersection of animal behavior and human behavior. Cy, of course, is a naturalist, journalist, and author. Her latest book, which is wonderful, is How to Be a Good Creature, a memoir in 13 animals. How are you, Cy Montgomery?
I am great, particularly because I'm talking to you.
We're loving that, too.
Well, it's great to talk to you, too. You know, they say, or some people say anyway, as California goes, so goes the country. Well, this is one thing I'd like to see roll from west to east. When couples divorce, deciding how to divide the animals, what's California doing?
Oh, this is fabulous. This is is a law that was signed Thursday. California courts are now allowed to make custody decisions based on a pet's well-being and not just on who paid to buy the animal. So this is fabulous. Animals are not being treated like property, like chairs, but they're being treated more like children.
You know, the thing I don't understand, when we all celebrate, I think the three of us celebrate at least, this kind of change, what is the argument against this? I mean, what family doesn't care about their pet? In most cases, I would argue, I shouldn't say this to Cy Montgomery, even more than some of the humans in their house.
They don't think it should be in the courts.
Why would you?
I think that's it.
But why? I mean, why?
Because they're animals, they're not people. I think that's it.
But how close do you feel to your dog, Marjorie?
I mean, we always joke about how people would rather lose their spouse than lose their dog. It's a sad state of affairs. But I think for many people, it's sort of true. But I think that's it. Is it not that the people think this is not something the court should get involved in?
I think that might be it. I honestly, anyone who doesn't know that animals are not property, but they're thinking, feeling creatures, I don't know anybody like that. But they do exist in the world. So that's the only reason I can think of this law just persisting. But happily, I mean, this bill, it joins similar laws that have been passed already by two other states, Alaska and Illinois.
Oh, I didn't know that. So,
and by the way, yeah. Cy, if mom and dad are equal, they've both been great to the dog, they've both taken good care of the dog, what do you think? Do they spend a few days with dad, a few days with mom? How do you do it?
Yeah, I would do it that way.
Yeah,
I mean,
just split it up.
The same thing that works for kids. My goodness, I mean, I've already confessed to you that my husband and I purposely didn't have children, but I still find myself driving my dog to play dates and taking him to dance class. So it is.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Dance class? What
yeah,
is he learning
then?
Doing the tango or what?
Send you guys a video of Thurber and I doing our canine freestyle class together.
Oh, I would love that.
I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Oh, we're talking to Cy Montgomery. Hey, Cy, you know, I used to live in New York City. I lived there for 15 years. And there was a New York Times story a couple of days ago that totally disabused me of something that I'm not sure if I believed or just wanted to believe. When I'd see a rat out on the street, and by the way, the rats in New York City are the size of little horses. I mean, they are, it is real, like Shetland ponies, and they are everywhere.
Well, there's a lot of good food down there, Jim.
I naively convinced myself, because I'm scared of rats, actually, like petrified of rats. I convinced myself that all the cats walking around would take them on and defeat them. And it appears from the New York Times story, I believe that, or I bought into that myth, because I equated a mouse with a rat, which are about as different as a, you know, well, not genetically, but as different as a horse and a rhinoceros. So the rats win those battles, apparently, yes?
Yes, I saw that article too. Oh my gosh! And it was funny because, as you point out, you're not alone in thinking that. Gee, you know, cats eat rats. And in fact, when this has been studied in other places like New Zealand, they have found when people run around examining cat scat, they find almost all cat poops have rat pieces in them. And in fact, cats in New Zealand prefer rats to birds. But
really?
You are right. These rats are half the size of New York City rats. I guess pizza rat is the reason. I mean, they're
oh,
all
I love
eating
that.
Pizza.
But babe, is that really the reason? Is because they're larger in New York City than they are in other places? Is that what it's about?
It probably is. I mean,
it makes
it's
sense.
A hard thing to study. One reason it's hard to study is that, you know, usually when you go to study animals on someone's property, if it's rats, people would rather you not catch their rats in live traps and then release them for further study. Mm-hmm. But in New York, they did find a place in Brooklyn. It was a recycling plant where these researchers were tracking 37 rats. They put these like little tiny radio frequency ID tags beneath the skin, and then they had all these motion-sensitive cameras to see what they were doing. And while they were doing the study, five feral cats took up residence in the recycling plant, and then they got to see what happened. And what happened was, one, the rats hid, so they were not likely to trigger the camera, but the cats
did not kill them. They did not find them. They did not chase them. Only two of these cats even made an attempt to chase them, and only one actually killed the rat.
You know, by the way, I hope people don't think I am. I don't want to scare you out of New York City, but I lived there for a long time. And if people haven't spent time there, when you're in the subway, particularly, and you see some of the rats, they're bigger than half the passengers. I mean, I'm serious. They are so big. It is just. It
well,
is terrifying.
If people haven't seen it, you mentioned Pizza Rat before. You can get it on YouTube.
Oh, it's the best video
it's a great
ever.
Is it real?
Do we know
we
that
don't
it's
know.
Real? Okay.
There was some dispute, wasn't there?
There was, yeah.
Anyway, this rat.
Well,
is,
if you handed a piece of pizza to a rat, I'm sure it would do exactly.
And it's dragging it down the subway steps
the
or something?
It's a piece of the triangle, taking it down the steps. I guess it's going to take it back home to the baby rats.
You know, Cy Montgomery, on a story with much more serious consequences. Well, I don't know. I guess there are serious consequences on the rat front, too. Tell us about this story out of Melbourne about this same-sex penguin couple incubating an egg at one of the aquariums there. Tell us about it and what the implications are.
Really, it's a sweet story. And it's just this lovely relationship. These two males named Magic and Sven became good friends, and they bow to each other and... You know, that's like proposing, actually, in penguin body language. Mm-hmm. And then they started to make a nest. Well, an egg came along that was being ignored and didn't even notice when the folks at the zoo moved the egg. And they gave it to Sven and to Magic. And they became some of the best parents that they had ever seen. And this is not the first time that this has been seen in penguins. And in fact, same-sex pairings is extremely common in birds.
Like really?
130 different bird species engage in same-sex behavior.
How about in cats and dogs? And do we know, are there gay cats and dogs?
Well, there's not a lot of data on this because most people neuter their pets.
Yeah. Right.
And a lot of sexual behavior, or we think it looks like sexual behavior, like mounting,
right.
is not done sexually. It's done as dominance, or it's done as play, which is why you often will see a dog mounting another dog's head, for example, which isn't going to work out very well sexually, but it works for dominance.
But
there are lots of other animals that form really important bonds that are necessary to raise a baby when it's same sex. It's not nearly as uncommon as people would have you believe.
But can we equate a bonding together of two non-human animals to raise a baby with them having a same-sex relationship? Do you know what I mean? As opposed to, is it the same thing, or is it just joining together, some might argue, for baby raising or for egg incubation? Do you know what I mean?
Well, for the longest time, that's what human marriage was for, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I guess that's, yeah. So how widespread,
I mean,
by the way,
you know,
how widespread?
In Victorian times, we didn't get married for love to start with. So you know, there's lots of different reasons that people form bonds.
How widespread, when you mentioned 130 species, I was shocked a second ago. How widespread are same-sex relationships in non-human animals across the board?
Boy, I don't know. I do know that in bonobos, who are very closely related to humans, that something like 60% of all sexual behavior is same-sex.
Is that
wow.
so?
Yeah. And wow. because they use sex... not for procreation, but they use it as kind of a social lubricant. Whenever there's tension in the group, bonobos, as you know, are pygmy chimps. They're a kind of chimpanzee, different from the Eastern chimpanzee that Jane Goodall studied. But among bonobos, whenever there's tension in the group, they release that tension by loving each other up.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah. So make love, not war.
We're talking to naturalist and journalist Cy Montgomery. We're going to keep talking to her right after this quick break. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
It's the WGBH membership drive. Who done it? You done it. The motive: you love Boston Public Radio. The means: whatever you feel you can contribute. The opportunity: right now. Call 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
So here's the deal, friends. There's a $25,000 match for any contribution you make in the next 29 minutes between now and 2 o'clock till the end of our show. I'll do the obvious: is $100 becomes $200, $500 becomes $1,000. It's fabulous. And if you do the sustaining gift of $10 a month, not only does that $120 a year become $240 for Boston Public Radio right now, you also get the wireless phone charger that we've been talking about nonstop today, which I think is great and really functional and useful and all those, well, I guess the same thing, functional and useful. In any case, $10 and you get the wireless phone charger. Just plop your phone on top of it. Don't have to plug it in. Just lay it on top of it and your phone charges. It is great. It's got the 89.7 WGBH logo on it. It's small. It's round. It's lightweight. It's great. Do it. 888-897-9424, WGBH.org. If you don't want to do $10 a month, you want to do less, you want to do more, or you're not into the phone charger, then give whatever you can, either a lump sum or as a sustainer. And we thank you very much because it allows us to do lots of wonderful things like this debate Marjorie and I are doing tonight with scores of our colleagues working to make it happen. That starts at 7, and the availability of the phone wireless phone charger expires at 7. So there's perfect symmetry there, Marjorie.
And the match expires in 27 or 28 minutes. There's only that much left in our show. And it really means a lot to me, particularly if you can give during our show, which is over at 2 o'clock. So whatever you can give, we'd really appreciate it. If you can give a little, that's great. If you can give a lot, that's really great. But the point is, until 2 o'clock, whatever you give is doubled by the WGBH Member Match Fund. As Jim said before, we always have a little gift to give you for donating and becoming a sustainer today for $10 a month. It is this wonderful little disc with the WGBH 89.7 logo, a wireless charger. You can just put your phone right on top of it, and you don't have to worry about breaking or wearing out the little portal in your phone that takes the charger. So it's a great deal. We hope you can contribute to it before 2 o'clock. Actually, though, I must admit, you can get the wireless charger until 7 o'clock, but the match is done at 2 o'clock, and Jim and I are done at 2 o'clock. So 888-897-9424, WGBH.org. Just 27 minutes left for that match double.
Nadine in Sudbury, thank you. Anna in Mansfield, thank you. Gregory in Shrewsbury and Linda in Burlington, thank all of you for making a contribution. Thank all of you who are about to make a contribution. 888-897-9424 or WGBH.org. It's like a twofer. Not only does it make us feel fabulous,
it does.
If you care enough to take a couple of minutes and make a contribution, whatever amount you can afford. But trust this, because we've been in the same spot you are now in when we didn't work here. And we both said, and it's true, you feel good when you do it. You do what you can afford. And it's a good feeling. I think it brings you even closer to this GBH community, which I assume matters a lot to you. You wouldn't have your dial turned to us right now. So do it now, please. 888-897-9424, WGBH.org. And we really appreciate it. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to naturalist and writer Cy Montgomery. She's joining us for this month's edition of The Afternoon Zoo. That's, of course, a look at the intersection of animal and human behavior.
So, Cy Montgomery, there was a very interesting story about man's cologne attracting tigers. But when I read further down the story, I read how this female tiger is dragging people off it by the neck back to the cubs, and they're eating the person. Ah!
Yes. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? My second book actually was about man-eating tigers, so my ears shot up when I saw this happening. This is a 5-year-old tigress, and they call her T1. And what I am wondering, one, is why is she killing people? Usually, with one exception, and that is the tigers who live in the largest mangrove swamp on Earth. But usually when a tiger starts killing people, you find out that that tiger has something wrong, usually a bullet. Usually someone has tried to shoot the animal and has wounded it so it can't get its normal prey. And I would not be surprised if when they catch this animal, they don't – if I'd be – very surprised if they don't find that she has some kind of an injury. She does have cubs too.
Because the natural prey is faster than the human being, or the element of surprise, or why? Why is it easier to catch a person than another animal?
Well, because we don't have hooves or horns.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
They normally would eat like a 400-pound sambar,
okay.
A 200-pound wild boar. And, you know, when you have to kill everything you eat with your face, you're risking, you know, getting a serious injury to your sense organs every time you have a meal.
But I mean, obviously, you're the expert in the area, and if you say there's ordinarily in a circumstance like this something wrong with a tiger, it wouldn't be attacking a human. I thought it was a function of a piece of good news, which is I think I read that in India the tiger population is actually increasing. And that's
no,
at the same
right.
time
right.
that India's got this a huge human population. So sort of like what we see when you see a wild turkey on Mass Ave in Cambridge. It's because there's less and less
God,
wild space for that turkey or for that tiger to be
right.
doing that thing. So it's likely that part of it is that we're required to share less and less space. Isn't that part of it,
yeah,
too?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But normally, even in close quarters, tigers will avoid people. But no, you are right. India's human population is multiplying at an astonishing rate, much faster than the tiger population is.
So what do you do, though? I mean, the goal is that the tiger population is soaring, according to what I read, which obviously is, I assume, something we all want to encourage.
Unless you're grabbed by the neck.
Right, exactly. So what does a place like India do?
Well, they're trying to catch
to allow
it
them. No, but
Calvin
they're
Klein obsession
they, no, but
cologne.
They want to catch this one. By the way, we didn't explain the reason is because the artificial fragrance of the cologne apparently matches that. Do you pronounce it civet? Is that what it is?
Right, right. A lot of human perfumes have civetone, which is originally it was extracted from the anal glands of the civet, which is a cat-like animal.
Who knew?
And it's used as a fixative. Yeah, I know.
And it supposedly makes tigers go nuts, right?
Cats.
Right.
They love it. They love it. I mean, they look like they love it. What they're probably trying to do is put their scent over that scent, which reminds them of the territorial scent of other cats. And if, you know, you put keep out signs all over your property and you find someone else is putting their keep out sign on your property, what do you do? Well, you rush out and you try to rub your scent over their scent.
I've done that a few times myself. Now, putting that aside for a second, so if you were an advisor at India and they have populations exploding, but they also are proud of the fact, I assume, that their tiger population is increasing, what's the coexistence formula? What's the trick? What do they do?
Well, I would point out that India's tigers now number 2,500.
Right.
And that the humans are by 2030 going to be 1.5 billion
right.
more
oh
than
my gosh.
China. So the human population is dangerously high, not just for the tigers, but for the humans, too. So used to be there were 4,500 tigers, not 45,000 tigers, not
wow.
2,500 tigers in India. So things have really gotten out of kilter. There's way more of us. We're almost like a jellyfish bloom in a lake, or in the sea. So the problem is there's way too many people to have enough space, to have enough food, or to have enough tigers. So I would rush to try to make sure that Indian women aren't forced to have child after child after mm-hmm. child after child. And I have friends in India who've had 8 children and didn't want to have 8 children, but they did not have access to birth control so that they could have 2 children who they could afford to feed. So that's what I would do about it.
Right, well beyond the tiger issue. You know, you mentioned jellyfish for a second, and you're a New Hampshire person. I read this story about freshwater. By the way, I'm going to sound like a total coward. I said I was scared of rats. I am also scared of jellyfish. I'm not scared of that many things. Snakes, jellyfish, and rats are at the top of my list.
I'm scared of cocktail parties, so I'll tell you what.
Well, in any case. But putting that aside for a second, I did not know, and maybe I'm in a minority, I didn't even know there were jellyfish in fresh water. So, one, tell us about that. And two, do they do the same unpleasant things that jellyfish in saltwater do? Thus?
Well, you know what? I didn't know we had jellyfish either.
In your own state?
Apparently. Yeah, we have them in New Hampshire. They're in Vermont. They're even in Walden Pond.
Really? And are they?
And everyone thinks, what are they doing there? They belong in the ocean.
Yeah, what are they doing?
Apparently,
there?
Well, we aren't sure. It's been known apparently for about 50 years that these little tiny quarter-size translucent blobs exist in fresh water in New England. But no one really cared because you almost never saw them. Some people think that they might be an introduced invasive species from China. Other people are saying, no, they're probably native. And I don't think that's been resolved yet. Nobody thinks they do any harm. They certainly don't hurt you when they sting. But all jellyfish do have tentacles that will sting their prey. But it doesn't hurt us, and they're just so little that they don't seem to be doing any harm to anything. They've looked at, they do eat small fish, which they sting to death and then eat, but then they become food for larger fish. So far, nobody thinks they're doing any harm. But the thing that is so weird is that it's been so warm lately that people are noticing them. They were there before, but swimmers didn't notice it. Fishermen didn't notice it. But now, before it was just biologists who had noted it and put something into some of the scientific literature. But now, they're traveling on the feet of birds, they're traveling on the hulls of boats, and either they are spreading and proliferating, or we're now noticing them, because they go through two different shapes in their lives. They're jellyfish have a phase in which they're little blobs known as polyps, which isn't the same thing that gets taken out during your colonoscopy, but it looks kind of similar. They're just like blobs that cling to rocks or logs. And they're seldom seen in the phase that looks like the jellyfish we all know and many of us fear in the ocean, when they have those bell-shaped forms.
Oh, yeah. Those harsh.
And terrifying. That's what they're seeing now.
Yeah. Can you tell me you got stung by jellyfish once?
I did.
How bad was that?
Well, it's,
when
it's
you were a kid or as an adult?
I was about 16 or 17, yeah. but the tentacles are long, and they can keep stinging you. You're trying to take them off, and you can't see them, and they're stinging all over you. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. You poor thing. What
it
did
hurts.
You do?
What did
I
you
know.
Do?
I got swollen, I remember, and I think I was supposed to put something weird on, like, was not bleach, or there's something. What are you supposed to put on jellyfish stings? I've forgotten. But whatever it was, I used it as an excuse to get the day off from work.
Ammonia, I think.
Ammonia, that is right,
yeah,
ammonia.
It denatures the protein. Ammonia will actually denature a lot of venom, like a bee sting.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So, Cy, before you go, one of the first times I ever talked to you was when, after you'd written one of my favorites, The Soul of an Octopus, really about, well, it's not only about your pretty intimate relationship with an octopus. You've never had any interaction with a jellyfish. Is that a safe assumption?
Well, once I got stung on the face by a little tiny jellyfish when I was in a shark cage.
She's in a shark cage.
But knowing you as I do, that probably didn't upset you, right?
No, well, it wasn't bad. It was a small jellyfish, and it just kind of felt like, I kind of thought it was a little kiss from the sea.
Oh, my
it
God.
It wasn't like what happened to poor Marjorie. God, I'm sorry. That
it's
that,
okay. I'm fine.
You heard she said a little kiss from
the sea. A little kiss from the sea.
Only Cy Montgomery. Yeah. Hey, Cy, you're the best. It's great to talk to you, as always.
Thanks so much. Cy Montgomery, really appreciate it.
Great speaking with you guys.
Great speaking with you, too. Cy Montgomery joins us every month for the Afternoon Zoo. She's a naturalist, journalist, and author. Her latest book is How to Be a Good Creature, a Memoir in 13 Animals. It's a really great book, too. Jim and I read it last month. Anyway, thank you so much, Cy, for joining us.
This is Boston Public Radio on WGBH, made possible thanks to listener contributions. Your support of just $10 or $20 a month keeps all these great conversations coming your way. Please take a moment to give now at WGBHnews.org or call 888-897-9424. And thanks.
Ashford, don't say no.
Okay.
So here's the deal. In exactly, what time is it? 15 minutes, this dollar-for-dollar match disappears, meaning at 2 o'clock. Give $100, becomes $200. Give $500, it becomes $1,000. Give $5 a month, it becomes $10 a month. If you give $10 a month, it becomes $240 for the year. And you also go home, or it comes to your home, this new wireless phone charger, which I've been talking about for hours. Last time I'll say it today, it's great. It's only available today. It's only available at 7 o'clock. It's this little round, lightweight disc thing with the 89.7 WGBH logo. It's totally wireless. You just put your phone on the disc. I have one at home, just not a GBH one. And you let it charge. It is fast charging, so you don't have to wait long. And you're not only powering your phone, you're really powering us with a gift of $10 a month as a sustaining member. So we hope you'll do it at 888-897-9424 or WGBH.org.
Yeah, it really does mean a lot to us that you take the time to give. We want to thank everybody who's taken the time to give today and all during this week when we've been on our pledge drive. Special thanks to Francis in Arlington, Joanne in Woburn, Robert in Lowell, and Ellie in Malden, who contributed today during this match drive. And as Jim just said, it's a great time to give because your amount is doubled. You give $10, it's $20. You give $100, it's $200. I mean, you get the idea. Whatever you give right now, in the next 15 minutes, will be doubled. And for $10 a month, this is a standard. Get that adorable little wireless charger. It is cute. It's white. It's round. It's like a small hockey puck. It has little blue letters with the WGBH logo on it. It's nice. And you can just, you know, for people that lose their phone all the time, you put it in the same place in your kitchen or by your computer, and you just stick your phone on there when you come home. And you're not chasing around the house all the time trying to find your phone. And again, if we didn't have these pledge drives, we would have commercials, and that would be awful. So we don't have commercials. We have these pledge drives a couple of times a year. They're quick. They're over fast. And that is it. And we go back to commercial-free radio 24/7, all day long, all night long here at WGBH. 888-897-9424, WGBH.org.
So our show's over today in 13 minutes. Our debate begins in 5 hours and 13 minutes. Marjorie and I are moderating this gubernatorial debate between Jay Gonzalez, the Democrat, the incumbent Republican, Charlie Baker. As I said to you before, it's donations like yours that allow us to do things like that. This is not just me and Marjorie showing up and asking questions. This is dozens of our coworkers from lighting to writing to sound to every single to construction of a place for a couple hundred people to watch the debate. I mean, there are a multitude of people who decide that it's important enough to do that kind of work so that you get to hear the two men who want to lead Massachusetts for the next 4 years. That's the kind of thing your money supports. So if you support that, please do it. The match disappears in 13 minutes. 888-897-9424, WGBH.org. And I know I speak for Marjorie and everybody at this station. Thanks for whatever you can do. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. We just have a couple of minutes left. We don't have time to take calls. But I just want to say this debate that we're doing is in 5 hours and 12 minutes.
Right.
And, you know, we solicited at the top of the show people if they had some additional questions, et cetera. I should say we're not 100% set on everything we're going to ask. We're going to meet after the show by 3 or 4 o'clock.
We're not going to have time to ask everything we want to ask.
Well, obviously. But I want to say this. We, earlier in the week, and even before we reached out to people to say, you know, what is it that you might want to hear from the governor and the person who wants to succeed the governor, Jay Gonzalez. We got a ton of feedback even before we asked for it on, was it Monday? It was Monday. A lot of that, I mean, the basic things, obviously, we figured out by ourselves. A lot of the nuance of what we're trying to get into tonight with Jay Gonzalez and Charlie Baker, a lot of the angles were really suggested by people who care about this stuff as much as we do. They just don't do a radio on a television show like we do. So we thank you for that. And I'm really excited about it. By the way, we have done, depending on which debate it is, every ballot question, every single constitutional office by the end of this cycle, except for the auditor. We just couldn't fit in time, and I feel bad about that. And it's because the sense we get is people want it. They want an opportunity to hear what their choices are on ballot questions, on candidates. It's great.
It's great to see people. I mean, last night they had the big Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz debate, and everybody was talking about it, and Beto O'Rourke came out, and he was very aggressive, and he was much less aggressive the first time around and stuff. It's great to see candidates go back and forth. I mean, how fun are presidential debates? And this is not a presidential – well, those are – at the end, it's just two people. But usually at the beginning, it's, you know, a big lineup of people that are running for office, but this is just two people, Charlie Baker and Jay Gonzalez. Another great thing is we just get to order pizza because we're all going to have pizza here tonight before the debate. And I'm very excited about that.
Let me tell you something. I was not going to go ahead with this. Were it not for The fact they're buying me, I think, a Caesar wrap. Can I also, the other thing.
I'm getting a pizza. I know
this,
wrap.
This is obvious. I'm going to say this.
Caesar wrap.
We have a lot of substantive questions, yes. Obviously, tonight. Mm-hmm. No, there are no huge surprises, frankly. It's the things you care about and talk about all the time.
Yep.
But, you know, often my vote, and I assume yours and everybody listening, is as much determined by what I think of the person and the character of that person and their temperament as I do about what they stand for. And one of the beauties of having an hour to listen to what they have to say is you not just understand their worldview, but you get a sense of what kind of person they are, how they'll govern, how they relate to people. So all that stuff matters when it's in the flesh. It's live tonight at 7 o'clock. On Monday, I'm doing a Secretary of State debate. The week after that, the only Lieutenant Governor debate. And
you are unreal, Jim.
No, that's not my point. My point is it really matters. And one of the beauties of public radio and television, you can afford to do that because a lot of commercial stations say, well, enough people are going to watch. Actually, they are interested, but they're not convinced of that. We are. So I'm happy we're doing it. I'm really thrilled that Gonzalez and Baker picked us to be one of the debate
thrilled.
Forums tonight. We're really glad to do it.
Is there three? I think there's three.
Three. There's a Globe Consortium one down the line. John Keller, our buddy did
WBC,
one. The
did
first one.
Before. He did a terrific job.
But this is it. Second tonight is the third one, and that's it. And then you got to decide who you want to lead the state for the next 4 years. And I would argue whether you love Trump or hate Trump, in the era of Trump, it's a pretty important decision, made even more important. So when you ask me tonight, Marjorie, what am I doing on my show? You and I are doing my show,
show,
live, hour-long debate, two gubernatorial candidates at 7 o'clock.
And I'm lucky I slipped right in there. I'm really
you did.
Lucky. I did. So thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio.
Tomorrow
we're going to be joined by Andrew Cabral, another edition of Law & Order, Alex Beam for his wild and crazy explainer, Paul Revel on education, including the big suit at Harvard University. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. We are a production of WGBH. Thanks for listening.
See you tonight, 7.
Bye.